Support for Boston Public Radio comes from New England Recovery Center, providing inpatient addiction treatment in state-of-the-art facilities located in Westboro, Mass. All major insurance plans accepted. Learn more at newenglandrecoverycenter.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, yesterday people in conservative Kansas voted overwhelmingly against removing the right to an abortion in their state's constitution. Is it a sign of things to come or an outlier? We'll open the lines to hear your thoughts.
Medical ethicist Art Kaplan on Radio's Alex Jones, who said the Sandy Hook massacre was made up. He faces mother of a dead child in court. Then the increasing scrutiny on Pennsylvania Senate candidate Mehmet Oz, who promoted dubious products he made money from on his TV show. Those conversations and more ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Howdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. And apparently, in about an hour and a half, the governor's going to shut down the Orange Line for a month, which is a pretty radical kind of thing proposed by Mayor Wu, I believe. We'll bring that information to you live as soon as we hear it, tentatively scheduled for 12:30. At least people aren't going to have to jump off the Orange Line. That's a plus, I guess.
Like into the mystic.
So in the first opportunity for voters to be heard on abortion since the landmark Supreme Court decision overturning Roe, voters in conservative Kansas sent what seems to be a pretty clear message: hands off our abortion rights. In a state where registered Republicans far outnumber Democrats, Trump won, I think, by 15 points, the margin on this amendment to the Constitution to repeal the right to an abortion lost 59-41, a landslide, shocking many political observers, including, I think, me and Marjorie, and might be a silver lining for pro-choice people going into the midterms who are mostly Democrats. Is that how you're reading the results out of Kansas? What's ahead on the state-by-state battle for reproductive rights in America? Can the anger that followed the Dobbs decision lead to electoral victories for abortion right candidates in the fall? Or was this Kansas vote an aberration, or at least will it be seen as an aberration? Give us a call or a text at 877-301-8970. Or tweet us at BOS Public Radio. So what do you think, Marjorie Egan?
Well, I think this is extremely good news that Republican women who joined in this, and we are sure that there are Republican women who joined in this because the voters in Kansas City are mostly Republican. I mean, in Kansas, the whole state, they outnumber Democrats, have said they're not going to be party to a forced birth possibility in their hometown. You know, a million years ago, when I couldn't imagine the Supreme Court would ever overturn Roe, I thought they might limit abortions. I never thought they'd overturn it. I thought, you know, the first time you hear about some horrible story, you know, and it's some pretty little blonde girl, you know, that ends up dying because of a forced abortion, which is, I mean, unable to get a legal abortion, the you-know-what would hit the fan for Republicans. And I think it started to hit the fan because it's so extreme. We heard the story about the 10-year-old girl who was a victim of incest who had to go out of state to get an abortion.
Ohio, Indiana.
You hear all these states that are saying there's going to be no exceptions for rape or incest. You hear stories about women who have miscarriages, which are very, very common. One in four pregnancies end in a miscarriage. It's going to have to somehow prove that she had a miscarriage, that she's mourning and devastated over, and she wasn't taking an abortion pill in order to get a D&C. I think the idea of politicians, many of whom are ignorant about abortion, and they're kind of, some of them, are not very upstanding people, telling women you have to give birth no matter what. I mean,
Unless it's their mistress, in which case they generally don't say that kind of thing.
Unless it's their mistress. I think it's just – so I'm obviously very happy about this, Jim.
Well, let me talk about the good news part of this first. The good news part of it – do you know that this is shocking. The normal vote, I think, in the last midterm primary election was 450,000 in Texas. Mm-hmm. In Kansas. You know how many people voted yesterday? 900,000.
Right.
Double the number. You know when the last time was that a Democrat won the electoral votes of Kansas? 1964 with LBJ. So it is a red state. The flip side of this, though, is this is not what people vote on necessarily in midterm elections. You don't vote for, am I pro-choice or am I anti-abortion? You vote for a candidate who has a position on a whole host of issues. This was a standalone issue. And you know what would have been brilliant? And this is afterthought, which once again shows how much smarter strategically the Republicans are than the Democrats. You remember in 2004 when George W. was running for re-election, what they decided to do, the Republicans, to draw voters out in a lot of states, was to put gay marriage on the ballot. When gay marriage was not – now it's wildly popular – at least with the public, it wasn't then. You know what people should have done if there was time in their states? I think 26 states allow ballot questions. After the Alito decision leaked, put an abortion question on the ballot to draw out people for whom that is a critically important issue and probably cause them to elevate abortion in terms of their ranking of issues when they're voting in the midterms. Obviously, it's too late for that now. On one hand, as I say, I'm as excited as you are. I think it's a huge victory in Kansas. The other hand is abortion, a standalone, is different from voting for or against the candidate who has a lot of position on a lot of issues.
I mean, the bottom line is it's nice to know that the people of Kansas think that women, all of us who are women and our daughters and our granddaughters, their lives count more than an embryo. I mean, that's what the really important thing is here.
Paul in Braintree says, Texas, and says, what's the matter with Kansas? Nothing is what he says.
That was the title of a great book, right?
We had him on the show. I can't remember his name, but we've had him on the show. 877-301-8970.
Amber in Worcester says, as someone who was born and raised in the Bible Belt, to me this is huge and finally a sign of change. I am positively giddy. And, you know, I have to point out, too, that the Catholic Church, and I'm a Catholic. I mean, it is hard to be a Catholic. Sometimes I think, what the hell am I doing as remaining a Catholic? But in any case, the Archbishop out there, they spent a lot of money out there in the Archdiocese of Kansas City to make sure that they were going to be able to get rid of these abortions out there. There were these two nuns who stood up against them and said, which is so
well,
because the point is, we're going to talk about this a little bit later with Art Kaplan. The states that want to ban abortion are the states that are crummiest and stingiest with women and children, children who are born and their mothers. They don't have health insurance. They don't have any kind of paid family leave. They don't have any help in their poverty. And it's mostly the main reason for having abortions is poverty. So I love the fact that these two nuns said, you know, We're not going to support this. We're going to go up against our archbishop, which is a big deal to do. They could be out in the street by now, for all I know, because the legislature doesn't support any of the programs that would help the children already born.
Well, they also said it was religious bias. Is
it
Catholics
is.
Imposing their beliefs on voters who are not Catholics?
Like Jews.
Like
and
Jews,
by the way,
right.
The Catholics didn't believe in life believes begins at conception until like 1860. And the Southern Baptists, the evangelicals, were down with abortion until the 1970s. So it's a bunch of baloney. It's a wedge issue to try to get people all revved up, and they've succeeded. 877-301-8970 is the number. You can call us or tweet us at that number. What do you think about this vote? As Jim said, it's a single-issue vote. It was on abortion. It's different than...
It's still amazing. I'm not saying... By the way, let me be clear. Single issue or not, in Kansas, to lose by almost 20 points in an attempt to eliminate the right to an abortion from a state's constitution is really huge. I just don't know. I hope it's transferable. I just don't know how transferable it is.
The GOP was very pro-choice for a long time. I mean, George W. Bush's father, he was a big, and Barbara was a big Planned
Till
Parenthood
Reagan,
person.
Right?
Yeah. Till
wait a second. I think there was a guy who was president who used to be pro-choice too until he told us on the radio that Supreme Court nominees had
Trump.
To be pro. Right. Yeah. He was big time pro-choice and all of a sudden decided for the same reasons he does anything
the point is,
to flip.
There are some people that are sincerely pro-life who are sincerely worried about the unborn. I would say their number among politicians is teeny tiny.
Well, they're only sincere if they care not just about the unborn, but about the born, to make your point from a minute ago.
And it's the same thing with the Catholic Church.
Let's go to Mary in the car. You're first in the wake of the overwhelming vote to retain the right to an abortion in the Kansas Constitution by Kansas voters. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey.
This is Mary, and I grew up in Kansas.
Oh, great.
A long time ago. Yeah. So, my take on it is that the Constitution of Kansas would be something that the voters would in general be reluctant to muck with.
Mm.
And so there's not only is it the issue about abortion, which I think there's support for that as well, looking at the map of the counties that voted no. But I think also a factor in this is that fiddling with the Constitution would be kind of extreme for the way I think that Kansas folks think. So,
well, they should actually then maybe teach a lesson to the justices on the Supreme Court about fiddling with the Constitution. Don't you think, Mary?
No kidding. Yes,
you know, Mary, when you mention the regions of the state, what's particularly interesting, the reddest regions of Kansas, I read this morning, where Trump did the best in both of his elections, while there was a margin in favor of getting eliminating the right to an abortion in the Constitution, the margin was much lower than the margin that by which Trump had prevailed. So even in the reddest portions of the state, there was much more support for the pro-choice position. Mary, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
It was the most rural areas that were most pro-forced birth.
Yeah, but not as overwhelmingly as you'd think.
Right.
I mean, even there was a lot more reason, and I guess you'd say, in people's votes. Where do you want to go?
Jasper in Marlboro. Thank you for calling.
Welcome, Jasper.
Hello. Thanks again, Marjorie and
whatever his name is.
Jen.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. I don't remember some days either.
My question is, as you guys are talking about abortion, I'm also thinking in regards to queer people. We know that DeSantis loves to attack LGBTQ+ people. Don't Say Gay has passed. Abbott, which is also runs an anti-abortion state, is also very anti-trans. And my question is, I'm just kind of sick tired of seeing us being kind of a beach ball in politics hands. Do you think that, I mean, I've kind of asked this question, is there any way we could see maybe a ban on conversion therapy? Massachusetts has banned it. It would definitely provide a lot of protection for queer individuals.
What are you talking about, something nationwide, Jasper?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. That would be ideal. We've been fighting for this for so long. It's a pseudoscience. I'm tired of seeing my siblings be put through that.
By the way, it's not just Massachusetts. I don't think it's a majority of states. I'm not even sure. One of our colleagues will pass, but a significant number of states have banned conversion therapy. And I think we're with you, Jasper. If every state were to do it or the feds were to do it, it would be a good thing for the health of the nation, and particularly some very vulnerable people.
Well,
Jasper, thanks for the call.
It'd be also to see, I mean, DeSantis is supposedly very popular in Florida. But again, so many people are now in favor of gay marriage. So many people are not only, you know, gay family members, gay close friends, or have changed their mind from the homophobia we used to have. Not that it's gone entirely, but it's certainly much better. You wonder whether that will ultimately bite him in the behind as well.
That's a good question. By the way, our colleagues, very quickly, thank you, Mackenzie, 20 states in D.C., this is for Jasper, completely banned conversion therapy for minors. 877-301-8970. We're talking about, in the wake of at least the celebration in this studio, about the vote of almost 60% of people in Kansas to retain the right to an abortion that exists in their state's constitution.
Sam from Beverly, thank you for calling.
Welcome, Sam.
This is Tim, actually, from
Beverly. Tim, sorry.
That's okay. I grew up in Kansas. I respected the Republicans I grew up with. We often voted for Democratic governors as well. I just want to mention that the reason Kansas had that decision by its own Supreme Court was that the Kansas Constitution is based on the Declaration of Independence and the rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, that's interesting.
In a 6-1 decision, the Kansas Supreme Court affirmed that. This was an attempt to change the Constitution. Kansans are largely libertarians, keep your government hands off of me.
Good.
And it doesn't actually surprise me, although I'm very pleased, that 60% of the people from where I came from. I've lived in Massachusetts since 1969, so I'm distant from it, but I'm very proud of Kansans today.
We're really glad you called. Give us a little history, Sam. Thank you. And apparently you can only call today if you were born and raised in Kansas, based on the first couple of calls.
Mark from Holden says, to misquote or give a different twist on the line from The Wizard of Oz, maybe Kansas is not in Kansas anymore.
So we have to take a break. Before we do, I want to read a text from somebody who wrote about an issue we both care a lot about that has nothing to do with this.
The
but
legislature?
They wrote this morning.
Oh, I saw that too.
After listening to Jim and Marjorie go on and on about legislature going on vacation for 5 months, I emailed my rep and asked them to come back in a session. The rep responded very thoroughly and basically refuted Jim and Marjorie, saying plenty can still get done and that they are not on vacation. Why were Jim and Marjorie being deceptive about this? Thank you, Adam. The reason we were is because we were not. Your state rep is. They are on a five-month hiatus. The only way anything can pass the legislature is if there is a unanimous vote without one single person. There are 199 legislators. There are 160 in the House, for example. If 159 vote for a bill during this informal session for 5 months and one person votes no, nothing happens. So you're Adam. Let me put this as kindly as I can. Your rep is full of crap. And I would suggest if he or she wants to talk to us, they can call us and we can explain how the legislature works to them. Thanks for your text.
Okay. We're going to keep talking about this for a few more minutes. The number is 877-301-8970. You can call us or text us at that number to give us your reaction to the vote in Kansas, which basically uphold the citizenry there wanting not to change the Constitution so the legislature could not go ahead and further restrict or even ban abortions in Kansas. You listen to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. If you're just joining us, we're taking your calls and texts on the results of in Kansas on this effort on the part of some to repeal the provision in the state constitution that granted a right to abortion in the state. It's a deep red state, as I think all of you know, and we want to know if you think this is an aberrational vote or if it's a glimmer of hope for those who want to see pro-choice legislators elected to places like Congress and in your state elections as well. Our number for texting and calling both is 877-301-8970.
You know, you also say to yourself, you think about where women were in 1973 and where women are now. Not that there isn't a long way to go, but it is a totally different world. You know, you were like begging back in the 70s to get someone to pay attention to you, no matter what the issue was. You know, couldn't buy a car by yourself, couldn't buy a house by yourself, couldn't get credit by yourself, all these things. I mean, it was almost like we were little puppies going, please, 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 let me do this, that, and the other thing. It's 2022. You know, if women are independent, women are rising up the ranks, more women in colleges and medical schools and law schools than men. It's a different world. I think these Republicans really overestimated women's willingness to be treated, as I said before, like that they don't even matter as much as an embryo.
You know, getting back to messaging on the part of the Democrats, and when I talk about Democrats here, with very few exceptions, they're almost all pro-choice in Congress. There are a couple of exceptions. And when it comes to Republicans, they're almost all anti-abortion, anti-choice in Congress. That's where I make the Democratic-Republican distinction here. There's got to be some messaging. And here's who wrote this? Bonnie in Brookline. Well, Democrats finally learn a marketing message. Run ads until the midterm, standing if Republicans get the majority, will lose the right to abortion in every single state with one federal law. The messaging does have to come out of this. As I said, the number of people who voted is double what would voted in the last primary election in Kansas. The point being that abortion can bring people out who might not otherwise vote. And if that's what brings them out, if that's the message, even though you're voting for a candidate, not just the issue, maybe they will make abortion their number one item and decide, I'm only going to vote for pro-choice legislators. So they got to get with it.
Well, they also know how unpopular the Supreme Court decision is, because a lot of Republicans don't want to talk about this, do they? What are you laughing at?
No, a lot of this. In responding to that guy, Adam, who said his state rep said they weren't on vacation, someone just texted and said, if the legislature takes a five-month vacation, have Jared fill in for the legislature.
Very good.
That's a good one. They didn't sign it. That's a really good one.
Who fills in here.
whenever either of us
either of us is on vacation.
Ann in Gloucester, thank you for your call. You're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Oh, hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was so happy about what happened in Kansas until this morning when I started reading some news on my phone news feed, and there somewhere I read that a reaction from some of the Republicans in Kansas is now to do what happened at the national level, and what they need to do now is replace the judges on the state Supreme Court that gave them that decision to begin with. They don't need to change the Constitution. They just need to change the judges who will interpret it in the way that they want to. And apparently a lot of these judges in their state are quite vulnerable. They were appointed by Democrats and
Ann,
we got to let you go. You have a horrible connection, but thank you for making the point.
That may well be true, Ann, and I'm sure that if you read it is. But what this would have done if they had voted the other way would have opened up the opportunity for legislators to change.
Do whatever they want, right.
And so I would think if you're a Republican legislature and you see this vote and you're interested in holding on to your job, you may not be quite as enthusiastic as, you know, embracing forced birth as you were before this vote.
Well, there's another thing. I mean, no one is suggesting, and maybe we should have been more explicit, that winning this vote doesn't guarantee that the other side is not going to keep fighting. The anti-abortion forces have been fighting since 1973 to overturn Roe v. Wade. They've lost a lot along the way until a few months ago. So I guess we should have been clear. It's a major victory in Kansas. There'll be more fights in Kansas. There'll be fights in virtually every single state, or at least the majority of states. But there's hope. I mean, there's
and
hope.
And it's also important to remember the whole anti-abortion movement was never really about abortion. It was about racism in Southern schools, mm-hmm. when the people that were down at the Southern Baptists and people that the evangelical Christians decided that picking on little black kids, not letting them go to kindergarten, was a bad idea. It didn't look good. It wasn't really a winning strategy. So they decided to talk about unborn babies. That was more of a winning strategy because everybody was on the same page, which is you can have an abortion up until quickening. And that is when you feel the baby, mm-hmm. which is pretty far along in a pregnancy. So it was all like a scam from the beginning. Pamela in the car. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you know, pigs fly. It's a cold day in hell. I never in a million years thought the blood red state of Kansas would so overwhelmingly flip the bird to these, you know, largely male white legislators that are trying to tell them what to do. And I think the irony abounds on so many levels. This is Republicans are supposed to be the party of small government. And the Republicans, Kansas is a largely Republican state, have told its government, get your nose out of my private life and my private parts.
Yeah.
And I think that this is just going, it's just the beginning. I think that there's going to be a big pushback, and I think it's a tectonic change. I am so proud of Kansas. I really am.
So am I. And by the way, I am another one, I should say, because of the biases that I have that I sometimes admit and sometimes don't. I was convinced this was going to pass overwhelmingly. Were you, Pamela, thanks for your call. Were you not convinced?
Well, as it got closer to the election, I thought it might be close. I got really worried when there was the misinformation yesterday about whether voting yes meant no.
Right.
There was the anti-abortion side was trying to convince people to vote the other way, and I was worried about a lot of confusion. But both sides spent an awful lot of money. And I, like I said, I just think it's a different time for women now. It's a really horrifying thing to think about. I mean, I've heard so many women say, I can't believe that my daughters are growing up with fewer rights than I had. You know, it's kind of like a real gut punch. It's saying your life, I'm repeating myself over and over again, but your life, your being for 16 years or 20 years or 25 years or 40 years, all your other children, your responsibilities, you as a person don't matter. What you are is a vessel for an embryo. I mean, this is what they're talking about. They're talking about 6 weeks abortion period, no abortions at all.
Board, right?
They're talking about maybe Maybe in some states, if you're a adolescent who's impregnated by your father or by...
Don't do that. A lot of Republicans said, defended the notion that the 10-year-old who was raped in Ohio should have had the kid.
I know.
Because life is precious and gifts from God come in strange kinds of ways.
And the inequality here, you know, we are not talking about whether men can get Viagra, are we? We're not talking about whether men have to go to some outpost like women did to have abortions, to have medical care. So everybody would know, oh, there goes Jim Browdy. He's going into the clinic to get Viagra, or he's going into the clinic to have something done with his prostate. Can you imagine men having to do that? That's what women had to do when they were going to Planned Parenthood, didn't they? Even though a lot of them are going there for birth control, they weren't going there for abortions.
I didn't, by the way, that's not fair. I pull the hat down, the brim. When I go get Viagra, I always pull the brim way down. Stephen Rentham, we want to get to him. You're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey there.
So as a pro-life person, yep. I actually wasn't surprised at all with this decision.
Why?
In my conversations with other pro-life folks, I think that there's been this sort of delusion about the popular support for complete abortion restriction in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe I've been cynical on the position for a while. So when I see a vote like this and I see only, you know, what, 40% of Kansans who wanted to restrict the right to abortion, to me, that doesn't surprise me. And, you know, as a pro-life person, I think that makes me say, you know, maybe this sort of legislative approach to dealing with this issue isn't the way that we should be going. So I know you've had a lot of, you know, people who are happy with the decision or whatever, but I just wanted to share another.
We're glad
time.
You called. Don't,
you know,
go away,
you know,
please, Stephen.
I was thinking that what would, because you look at the polls and a lot people don't. There's a mushy middle. People that really do not like abortions late and pregnant, they don't want a 15-week abortion. They don't want a 18-week abortion. If it's a 3-week, six, well, not 3-week, but 6-week or 8-week or 10-week, I thought the Supreme Court might have said, we're going to go with Mississippi.
That's what
we're going to
restrict wanted.
Abortions after 15 mm-hmm. weeks. I think a lot of people would have been maybe not thrilled with that because they don't want the government making those private decisions for women, but they would have thought that was more reasonable.
That's what you're arguing, Stephen. Is it not that that is the sane way for your side to go here? No? Strategically?
Right. I mean, sort of, I guess my preference would be no abortion, of course, mm-hmm. but I would rather take something that is going to be more palatable than to more Americans than nothing. And again, for me, it's not a, you know, an anti-woman issue. It's just like a really uncomfortable reality of if you believe that the unborn are human beings, and I have a belief that all human beings have, you know, an inalienable right to life, I have to, you know, I have to support that.
Well, Stephen, we really appreciate it. We hope you call back again because we're out of time, because when you said my choice, if I had my way, was no exceptions, I think that's a hard case to make, even for a person, self-described pro-life person. But we really appreciate your call, Stephen. Hope you call again.
Coming up, we're going to talk with our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. Speaking of the abortion issue, in Georgia, do you know an embryo, Jim, is going to soon count as a dependent on your taxes there?
Get a deduction.
Yeah. We're also going to talk about Sandy Hook denier Alex Jones facing the mother of a child murdered
great,
in court. Our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, is next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. We're joined now by medical ethicist Art Kaplan. Art is the Doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor and founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Hey there, Art.
Hey.
Hey, Art Kaplan. Great to talk to you, as always. Well, we just talked about Kansas with our listeners, and in elections yesterday, voters there said they did not want to enable the legislature to ban abortion by making a change in the laws there. But I wanted to talk to you about this great New York Times piece that talked about the real hypocrisy of states that want to ban abortion. It seems to be not about helping children, because the states with abortion bans are the least supportive of mothers and children when they're born. Horrible infant and mother mortality rates. You go right down the list for lack of support. What do you make of this?
Well, first, I think I'll chime in and reinforce probably what others are saying. That Kansas result was usually surprising to me in a state that Trump won by 14 points. Yeah. And I think it bodes well for Democrats and going down the road. And thank goodness for women, because that's who's driving that issue. And they're out and they're mad, and they should be. You take away their rights. You force them through an unwanted pregnancy or one that is dangerous to their health. I'm really thrilled to see that result. And Marjorie, you know, it's the old saw about the states that are toughest in terms of saying no to abortion. They absolutely respect fetal life from conception to birth, and then they don't care. So it's, you know, there's no support for women once they give birth. There's no guaranteed visit to the home to make sure they're breastfeeding. There's no social support. Even things like school lunches are under attack. Not in Massachusetts, which just said they were going to do it, by the way. But in many states, the only meal a kid can get in, you know, first or second grade is at school, and they're pulling the program. So I think it's moral hypocrisy in the extreme. If you're going to be pro-life, then you have to be pro-life, you know, throughout the child's lifespan. You can't just say, I only care about embryos. Speaking of which, Georgia just passed a law saying if you are carrying an embryo of any, I think it was 6 weeks or later, you can take it as a tax deduction. Yeah. You don't like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's a...
Do we know where the IRS is on this? I'm not...
I don't know.
Can we get back to this thing that you and Marjorie first... This is... The New York Times did a brilliant analysis comparing services in states where abortion is banned or likely to be banned versus unlikely to be banned. Uninsured women in banned states, 16%. Only 9% in states that are where it's unlikely to be banned. Uninsured children, 7.2% to 3.6%, double. Teen births, 21% to 12%. You were kind when
maternal
you said hypocrisy.
And infant mortality.
Right. 6.3 to 4.7. Total frauds. I mean, we keep quoting almost every day. We keep attributing this to Barney Frank. I hope it's Barney Frank. Life begins at conception for Republicans and ends at birth. I mean, but that is the bottom line. It is unbelievable. Sadistic.
And let me also add, the Catholic Church, of which I am a member, is equally hypocritical about this because they're always putting money behind these anti-abortion candidates, but they are not coming out in favor of policies, legislative policies, as these two courageous nuns in Kansas pointed out, at great risk to their futures. They could be thrown out of the houses where they live if past experience it predicts what's going to happen
in
the future.
Well, you know, I'll jump in and say you are not a credible pro-life proponent if you can't point to what you're doing to make healthier kids and create a social safety net for children. You just can't. It's just not morally consistent, and that's where you've got to be. And I could respect that if we saw some of that. I get the arguments on the pro-life side. I don't happen to agree, and I don't want to ban abortions and so forth, but if you were pro-life, you better be pro-life across the lifespan.
You know, Art, that was great news. I have to say I got even more satisfaction out of the brilliance and courage of Scarlett Lewis, who I interviewed years ago. She was the her son, Jesse, was, I think, six when he was killed at Sandy Hook in 2012. And by a quirk of fate, when she testified yesterday in their litigation that she and one of their family have against Alex Jones, everybody remembers on InfoWars, he's talking about how they're false flag, they're crisis actors, all that sort of stuff. And they're asking, Lewis and this other family are asking for $150 million, which could pose a great threat to Alex Jones. By a quirk of fate, he was in the courtroom when Scarlett Lewis was testifying.
Well, he should have been in the courtroom the entire time.
I agree with you. I don't
get
that.
He's a defendant.
But here is a brilliant, a small piece of the staring into the eyes of, as the New York Times described him, the squirming Alex Jones. Here's Scarlett Lewis.
It doesn't exist that I'm deep state. It's just not true. I know you know that. That's the problem. And you keep saying it. Why? For money? Because you've made a lot of money while you've said it. I know you believe me. And yet you're going to leave this courthouse and you're going to say it again on your show. You're saying no. You just did it.
By the way, and the reason for whatever what she was referring to at the end is her, I think it's her ex-husband, the father of Jesse, testified before when Jones was not there. And Jones was not there for the testimony because he's down the street taping his show, trashing the testimony of the father of Jesse. Was this not a brilliant moment for a courageous family,
Absolutely
Art Kaplan?
Brilliant. I'm going to tell you what I think of Alex Jones, and I'm saying this intentionally. He is the Jeffrey Dahmer of the media when it comes to this story because he is cannibalizing dead children mm-hmm. for his pleasure and his profit. He is so repugnant, it is unreal. I'm 10 miles from Sandy Hook. My house is. It was down the street. Politicians were there. Police were there. Obama was there. I mean, how could anybody go around saying it's a false flag or it's a conspiracy or something set up to control guns? And not only has he been doing it, how long has he been doing it? Like years at this point? And the other thing that he's done, which is consistent with his complete absence of any morality whatsoever, he's been declaring bankruptcy all over the place to evade accountability and protect his assets.
Well, we should also point out that his followers have harassed and the parents to the point where people have had to leave their houses. Mm-hmm. They had to get security protection.
They moved their houses.
They had to move out of their homes because these people were accosting the parents of dead children and calling them liars and horrible things on the street.
And where are the right-wing voices, the conservative voices in condemning this guy? I mean, where are they?
I don't know. I haven't heard any.
It's for the children that they serve, though, of course, unless it's Alex Jones. By the way, if people have never watched even a minute of InfoWars, it really is worth a minute of your time, even if it's not about Sandy Hook, to show how out there this guy is, which makes you realize how really out there his followers have to be, mm-hmm. who are huge in number, because it's like pathetic, almost like comic in the worst sense of the word. Performance art. It's pathetic and good. Again, if you have not seen or heard Scott Lewis's staring into the eyes unerringly of this monster, Alex Jones, check it out when you have a chance. We're talking to Art Kaplan.
So, Art Kaplan, you have some great quotes in a Daily Beast piece about Dr. Oz, who's running for Senate in Pennsylvania. Not doing very well, by the way.
Because he's traveling in his mansion in New Jersey almost all the time.
Yeah, part of his problem is he can't find Pennsylvania. Well, there.
But you are focusing on what he used to do on his television show, calling what he did completely dubious, ethically questionable, maybe not illegal, but ethically horrible, a mountain of conflict of interest. What were you talking about?
So we know that he has been promoting supplements and all manner of quackery on his show, which he doesn't do right now. I guess they pulled it because he's running for office, but his old Dr. Oz program. What he never revealed was that when it came to the supplements, he had ownership in the companies. He was plugging stuff that he owned. That is the conflict of interest 101. No. You cannot sell and promote as a doctor what you, if you will, own. So the AMA code of ethics, every code of ethics says you just can't do this. He never admitted to it. And in fact, when asked about it, you may remember they hauled him in front of Congress a couple of years ago. He lied. He didn't admit to it. So, you know, Dr. Oz got to go to Kansas. I mean, this is not anybody who should be holding office.
You know, by the way, there are two kinds of sins here. One, not disclosing ownership of a company, obviously, as a financial interest. And two is, even if he doesn't own it, prescribing, you know, to use your word, which I love, quackery, you know, snake oil kind of thing. Yep. So I don't know if this is – we're going to play a little example of people who haven't heard any of his dubious medical advice. I don't know if this is just quackery or this is an area where he actually owned a share. But here's a little bit of him promoting a drug on his television show.
And now I've got the number one miracle in a bottle to burn your fat. It's raspberry ketone. We're kicking it off with what I believe is one of the most important discoveries we've made to help you burn fat faster. green coffee bean extract. This is what forced colon does to your belly fat. Whoa!
Ooh.
And as it burns it away, what's left behind?
Muscle.
Muscle.
I have to say, in the spirit of full disclosure here, I got it with free shipping. So it wasn't quite as... So I'm going to ask you the same stupid question I ask you almost every week. How is this not an ethical violation that causes a doctor to get de-doctored or whatever? I don't understand this.
De-licensed, yes.
De-licensed.
Well, obviously, one problem is we don't know what state to chase him down in. He's on the move all the time. By the way, did you see one of the great trolls of Dr. Oz was his opponent, a guy named Fetterman, who's a character who...
great, actually.
People ought to watch him a little bit. He's a lot of fun, in addition to being, I think, savvy. But he tried to get him entered into the New Jersey Hall of Fame.
Oh, no, that's great. That's great.
Well, you know, I also want
to... Anyway, but to answer your question, he should lose his license for this violation of not disclosing his ownership. You can go around babbling on about coffee bean extract, and raspberry ketone, whatever it is. But you'll probably be able to slide because those are foods and it's tough to lose your license over a food prescription, even if it doesn't work or do anything. But this conflict of interest over touting things you're selling that you own, that is a death sentence. He should be losing his license over that.
And I also want to credit Michael Hilsick, who used to work for the Providence Journal. I knew him for years. He's a great columnist for the Los Angeles Times, who did a lot of the exposés.
Oh, he did?
Yes. Another great media newspaper story from the much-hated media.
Let me just say one last thing, but we don't have time for this today. We can maybe discuss it another day. Fetterman, who's the lieutenant governor, who's the Democratic nominee, who's winning by 10 or 11 points, also has his own problems. He had a stroke early in the campaign, and I think it's clear there was not full transparency in terms of the damage that might have been done, his recovery. So he's got some explaining to do, too. You know, Art, you were the one who taught us years ago.
And by the way, I got to jump in there because I want to come back. Just for a second, did you all watch pictures of Trump at his LIV golf tournament?
Yeah, he looked terrific, don't you think? He looked good.
Yeah, he looked great. He really looked tip-top, healthiest person ever to be in office, blah, blah, blah. Something's got to be done about the politicians and their health status. It's my weekly whine. Could we ever, have any independent assessment of high-level candidates rather than listening to all this blarney they push?
I'm totally with you. By the way, what I started to say was you're the one who told us years ago, which neither – I don't think you knew either. I didn't know that Medicare was not statutorily prohibited from negotiating drug prices, which is just staggering to me. Well, finally, the campaign to change that, which the Democrats have been at for decades, produced some fruit. It's not huge – but it is clearly a foot in the door
big.
So tell us a little bit.
It's going to implement for 3 years, but they're allowing negotiation between the government, who buys drugs in Medicare, and the pharmaceutical companies to set a price. Before, it was basically, here's the price from the pharmaceutical industry, you pay it. Mm-hmm. Now you can do what every other country in the world does, well, at least 3 years from now you will, which is to sit down and say, this is what we're willing to pay. They counteroffer and you come to some agreement and you drive the price down. Only applies to 20 drugs initially, common ones. They're going in, they're entering this thing like it was, invading the Normandy beaches or something. They're coming in slowly, carefully. I would do it tomorrow morning for everything. But hooray, this is a really big aspect of that bill that Manchin finally came around and let go.
By the way, one thing, insulin is still excluded, which is horrible. And since we trashed Susan Collins almost every opportunity, Collins and...
Murkowski.
No, New Hampshire's, one of the New Hampshire senators.
Maggie Hassan?
Shaheen and Collins are co-sponsoring an amendment, they hope, to this bill that would cause insulin to be thrown back in into those drugs for which you can negotiate price.
I think insulin was invented and rolled out about 1906. So the fact that we're sort of selling it under patent framework is a little odd, slightly.
You know, I had a quick question about this. This Washington Post story says that by 2024, this law would eliminate a 5% copay on drugs for catastrophic coverage, like cancer. That's
a big deal, too.
Yeah, but it only talks about eliminating the 5% copay. So I'm wondering, does Medicare not cover catastrophic coverage for cancer?
Well, it does.
It does.
It just pays heavy, heavy prices. And there's been a push to sort of shift some of that onto the patient. Imagine having cancer and then finding out, we're going to make you pay a little more. That makes no ethical sense whatsoever. That's where you want the government to step in and protect you. We haven't solved by any means the price problem for cancer treatments or drug costs. But this is incrementally a big deal, as it's starting to say, limits on copays, negotiate prices. I'm all for it.
So if you are a person with no money, you're not going to be able to afford copay for very expensive cancer.
Correct.
Under existing law, yeah.
And that's why I think about the biggest cause of medical debt in America is still hospital cost.
Okay.
So, Art, rebound COVID, one thing that Joe Biden and I have in common.
That's
we
right.
both had COVID.
She
we
was
both,
a rebounder.
We both took Paxlovid, and we both got it a second time. Originally, the notion was, the experts were saying, and I don't think disingenuously, they just didn't know it was evolving, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4% experienced Paxlovid rebound. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the number's a lot higher, maybe because of the BA5 variant. Some are saying as high as 40 to 50%. Actually. Mm-hmm. So what does one do with this? I mean, Paxlovid works, from what I understand, to make it far less likely you're going to be hospitalized or die, neither of which are desirable things. So what does one do about it, except with that knowledge, I guess?
Yeah, we have to do two things. One, people say you can take it up to 5 days post-diagnosis of COVID.
Right.
Would it be better to take it after 2 days? We got to do some studies to determine whether you get more efficacy if you take it quicker. I'm also going to say, I'm not 100% sure we really know what the optimal dose is, how much to take of the stuff, because we rolled it out fast to be preventative. I get that. That's the ethical thing to do. But we're kind of ignorant about what's the best way to use this antiviral drug. Mm-hmm. So we got to keep studying it. Remember, the best thing to do still is to get double boosted. That seems to keep you alive post-COVID, seems to shorten up the length of time you're sick. This antiviral thing helps, but a lot of people don't get it fast enough. They don't even get it within the 5 days. By the time they realize they've got it or reinfected, the 5-day window has passed.
Now, so, Art Kaplan, I understand we're going to break some news here about a panel you're involved in. Please tell.
Tomorrow, right?
Us.
Tomorrow. Going to be at 11. I'll tweet it at Arthur Kaplan if you want to come to the panel. Anybody can go. Big news. Scientists at Yale have taken a pig, which was dead, literally dead, deceased, for 1 hour, poured a solution into it. I don't even know what the composition of this stuff is, but basically administered it into the body of the pig and got cell activity in some of its muscles and organs, meaning the headline will be, do we need to rethink when we're dead? That's pretty big news. I don't know whether the brain of this pig worked or it's just getting some activity back in organs, but I'll say two things. One, there's going to be a big discussion, and listeners watch for this. It'll hit the news later this afternoon, and there'll be big stories tomorrow in all the papers about what's called the Organ X experiment. Rethinking the definition of death, do we always have to use this kind of solution down the road before we say you're dead, just to see? And then maybe it can help us get more organs, because maybe it doesn't do anything for our brains, but if it helps save your liver or your kidney, then maybe you'd get more organs.
Wait a second.
You could live forever.
No, first of all, you know what this reminds me of? Art is describing this comment. This is analogous to Governor Baker was in our studio the day that the woman had to jump in the Mystic River because the train was on fire a couple of weeks ago. And we're treating it like, just another day. You jump in a river so you don't die in a burning train. Art is there's a dead pig brought back to life. Art is saying we have a forum tomorrow on a dead pig who's this is potentially, I don't want to jump the gun, even though I'm about to. It's huge. Is it?
It's big.
Well, you know
and
what this...
I'm not sure yet whether we, in a bad moment, I sometimes say this must be like the Lazarus experiment.
Exactly.
You know, waking people from the dead. But I'm not sure we're waking them up totally. I think we got some evidence that some of their body parts seem to recover. But if the brain wow. didn't, then I think we're still dead. But
well, Art, you don't realize you don't realize that Jim Browdy has been secretly inspired by Ted Williams and the head on the tuna can up at the Cryogenics.
We have to give Ben Bradley Jr. credit for that in his book on Ted Williams.
On Ted Williams, said that Ted's head is on a tuna can. That Jim was planning on following.
By the way, Walt Disney, too.
That's right.
What's that?
Three tuna
Walt
cans.
Walt Disney, too. You can have the triad. It's Jim, Ted, and Walt.
No, you know what the problem is? I went to my physician. They said there's no tuna can big enough.
For your head.
That's the that was the point, Marjorie. Thank
you
very much.
What you have to do now, Jim, is keep a bottle of Organ X by your desk, ready to go.
Let me tell you.
Fire.
I have my raspberry ketone from Dr. Oz and whatever that. So if people are interested in participating in this, which they can, they go to your Twitter account, at Arthur Kaplan with
Kaplan,
a C.
Yep,
Kaplan.
It'll be at 11 a.m. tomorrow. We have the scientist who did the experiment.
Whoa.
Of Ephesus.
Great.
And I'll moderate it. It should be quite the little event.
Good to see you, Art Kaplan.
Really exciting,
good luck tomorrow.
Art Kaplan.
We'll be checking out. Take care.
Bye. Thank you very much. I think you could fit on a can of Dinty Moore beef. Too. What do you
Which
think?
Was my favorite food when I was a
How about that?
Kid. How do you? Dinty Moore was the best brand.
Dinty
and
Moore.
A little grizzle on the beef.
Little,
that was
right.
a problem, but it was so good.
Do it, Jim. Dinty Moore.
I often couldn't wait till my mother heated it up. I just ate it right out of the can cold. So good.
Okay. Art Kaplan is the doctor. It's William F. Virginia Conley, Mini
the
professor.
Ted Williams story is true, by the way.
It
if
is
people
true.
Don't realize it is a true story, God, I'm sorry.
As reported by Ben Bradley, Ted Williams on tuna can.
Ben
the
Bradley
splendid
Jr.
splinter on a tuna can.
That's right, yeah.
That's awful.
Okay.
Art Kaplan is also the founding head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU School of Medicine in New York City. He's got this fascinating panel coming up tomorrow about the dead pig. If you want to go, you tweet him at Art Kaplan, correct, Jim?
That is right. Or no, at Arthur Kaplan.
At Arthur
and
Kaplan.
And Kaplan's
Thank
with
you.
A C.
Arthur Kaplan with a C. Thank you. Okay, coming up after the new news, we'll hear from national security expert Juliet Kayyem on 2020 election deniers winning key primary races around the country and some other... Well, okay, news. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's recent trip to Taiwan against the wishes of the president spurred outrage from China officials. What will it mean? National security analyst Julia Kayyem updates us on that and the U.S.'s killing of the mastermind of 9/11. Then Lyndia Downey, head of the Pine Street Inn, joins us to talk about the state of homelessness in Boston as we face another heat wave. We'll also talk about their life-changing push for permanent supportive housing.
Travel guru Rick Steves is back from a whirlwind trip to Europe. He'll get us up to speed on the hidden gems of Madrid and the Baroque sex and inbred kings with horrible underbites of Vienna. And Boston Globe Love Letters columnist Meredith Goldstein with her latest advice on love and relationships, including what to do if your divorced spouse, decades later, wants to take another shot at marriage. Then we'll open the lines to hear your take on Boston's booming rat population. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Hi, I'm Marjorie Egan. He's Jim Brown. That's what you're supposed to say. Hi, I'm Marjorie Egan.
Didn't turn off the microphone. Sorry about that. Welcome to Boston Public Radio, hour number two, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim. Hello, you look at a kick out of that.
Hello again, Marjorie. She's not in an apron today, I should say.
Well, he doesn't tell you that the reason I was late because I was in across the hall solving all his problems.
I had some mechanical problems that she was solving.
And
that
he
may
sends
be
me
true.
To take care
I
of
didn't
them.
Send you. I
yes,
asked you
did.
If you'd be nice enough to do it. In any case, you just heard Henry talk about the buses that were approved by the MBTA types. Because in about a half hour, Charlie Baker's shutting down the Orange Line for a month, which, by the way, may be the kind of radical solution, according to Mayor Wu, that needs doing. So we'll let you know what he has to say as soon as he says it. But first, in Michigan, Arizona, Missouri, Trump-backed candidates won their GOP primaries. In Arizona, far-right candidate Mark Finchem, who rejects the 2020 election results, will be the GOP candidate for Secretary of State. if he wins the general election in the fall, he will oversee that swing state's election process in 2024. And by the way, he is not the only one. Joining us now to discuss this, I don't know what we call it, voting security implication, is Juliette Kayyem. She's a former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under Barack Obama, the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Her latest book, of course, is The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Hello, Juliette Kayyem.
Hi to both of you. I'm smiling because I've been doing this for years now, and I would say 80% of the time, Marjorie often looks like it's like her first show. Like, she literally was... She's like... touching stuff, whatever. Yeah. I'm
she's spontaneous.
Spontaneous
person. Haven't you ever heard of the beginner's mind, the Zen Buddhist thing? It's supposed to be like a beginner's mind. I approach show.
Everything is if it's
new? Everything is new. So I ascribe to that. Me and Steve Jobs.
Yeah, also, I also, as a hand gesturer herself, often I really appreciate it.
That's so nice.
Well, there you go. As I said, I was delayed because I was doing Jim's bidding.
Of course you were. Everyone knows that.
So to get back to what Jim was talking about with these election deniers had prevailed in some of these big contests, if they do beat the Democrat, especially in the Secretary of State's position where they could really have huge power over election counting and vote counting, are there any safeguards, or is it just going to be that we'll face fraudulent elections for real?
Well, yeah, I mean, there will be attempts by these secretaries of state to limit voting. Obviously, that's a goal that we've seen in Texas and elsewhere. You make it harder for certain communities to vote. So let's assume that he wins in Arizona, which is a swing state. So I view that win as the most dangerous of all of what happened yesterday. So he has to be defeated, and there'll be lots of money to defeating him. These people, you know, when they are put under some glare, often fall apart. Eric Greitens is one of them who did not get the nomination in Missouri.
He was the one with
the wife abuser. And other, I mean,
but let's just be clear, Jim, we don't know about this guy. No, he's like literally like this guy is. There are going to be multiple stories about, you know, QAnon and maybe worse. And so hopefully Arizonans will realize this is the change. But if he does win, then of course there's courts. I mean, you know, if you know, you can't just make things up, right? And so there might be lots of contention, but it's not like he's the final say. And if Trump is not president, which he won't be during that election, you know, without a national conspiracy to do this, it is a little bit harder. I mean, what we're seeing now disclosed in the January 6th, I am not saying this is good news. As I said, this is the worst. This is, to me, the worst piece of news, the Roe stuff being the best piece of news in a complicated night of back and forth.
I'm going to make the news worse, I think, in a second. But first, for those who think we're being hyperbolic, let's hear from Mr. Fincham himself.
Yeah.
He was at the January 6th insurrection. Again, he just won the GOP nomination to Secretary of State. Here's a little bit of what he had to say about the last election.
Donald Trump won.
Yep.
And he won big.
Yeah.
I think if we are ever able to get to the truthful result, if we are able to, well, it's irredeemably flawed, so we're not going to be able to. I suspect that Donald Trump probably won by at least the margin that Ronald Reagan won, if not greater.
You know, do you believe we're living in this land?
No, but what do they call the people in Arizona that were counting the votes and they kept?
No, they were from Florida, but they were counting them in Arizona.
Yeah,
the
ninja.
Okay, but let me make it worse as I wanted. It's not just Fincham. And I may have some of this wrong because I can't read my writing. Yeah. In Nevada, this guy Jim Marchant, I think, is also the Republican nominee, Secretary of State. Christina Karamu in Michigan, same deal, all election deniers. In my home state of Pennsylvania, Mastroianni, who was at January 6th, who's the Republican gubernatorial nominee, the governor picks the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. So there are at least four swing states.
Yep.
Four, not one. Four swing states where the Republican nominee for Secretary of State in charge of elections is a an election denier.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is where you're going to have to start a litigation strategy during the primary. I will say this was a splintered field in Arizona. I don't want to say I'm confident. I'm never confident about elections, but I'm not. I wasn't born yesterday. This guy is no Trump. You're going to have a Democratic challenger. You're going to have a very contentious gubernatorial race, which is going to bring Democrats out. So I'm not saying this is settled there, but he's not the final word, but these are bad news stories. And, you know, I always go back to that line after the election, some Republican anonymously said to Politico or some news organization, you know, what's the harm in flattering him, Trump, for a while, like letting him believe that he won and then he'll finally concede. Well, now we know you see the harm. I mean, these people are never satiated. I mean, I think about that with the abortion ruling. Like, I mean, have you ever seen people less happy about a major victory on their side? I mean, the most miserable people in the world. I mean, it's like you would have thought we lost, the pro-choice people. But and so we'll see what happens. I actually think the Trump's all other stories, and I'm not being I think I'm right about this is what happened in Kansas.
Well, we spent most of the first hour talking about it. I'd like to hear your two cents.
Give us your take.
I'll do it from the security perspective. So, because I do think it is interesting. So when I think a couple weeks ago I was on, I said, you know, these people, the pro-lifers are never satiated, right? So they get the victory that they want in court. That's not enough. So they're pushing for a federal abortion ban. So, I mean, let's just be clear here. It was BS that they believe that this should go to the states. These people, they are not federalists in the sense, because when it goes to the states, then they fight it, right? Then they're still mad, right? So, and that's that disconnect between what they want, which is a total ban, no exceptions, woman dies, you know, incest conceived baby has to be born, like, you know, to a teenage girl who should not be having babies, like, you know, all the disgusting stuff that these guys are into, and they are into it. Let's just be honest here. They are into it.
What do you mean they're into it?
It's a perversity. It's a power. Yeah. It's a perversity. And unless we call it that, it's perverse.
I mean, anti-woman.
It's disgusting to have a 10-year-old girl. I mean, let's just be honest. It's a sexual perversity. I think I hear these people. I'm like, that's a sexual perversity. It is. There's nothing like pro-life. There's nothing pro-life about it. Anyway, so that's where the anger is building, because they see two things. One, they see that some of the states don't want it. Don't want these bans. The other is that states they thought wanted the bans are Kansas is great. This is both a sort of security moment because people become radicalized, but I think it's also a shut up moment. I mean, I think that the Republicans played this politically, forget the science of it, played this so poorly. If they had embraced the exceptions, the non-perversity. I mean, it's just gross. It's just gross.
You know, what's interesting, if I can make this analogy, which probably will aggravate people, so while you're doing it, Jim, is we had the guy Stephen from Renton. Was Stephen from Renton a call before identified himself as pro-life?
Right.
And he said, you know, if I had my choice, there'd be no exceptions or something. However, strategically, he thinks what Juliet's discussing is the extremism of their position.
Strategic. Yeah, crazy.
You know what the analogy is that you and I have talked about for years? Rent control. In Massachusetts, a lot of people believed before it was repealed, 51-49 in the 90s,
too extreme,
that if the pro-rent control people like me had said, we do have to make exceptions for people who own their own homes, who want to live in them, and a whole bunch of three-deckers, that sort of thing, it would have been preserved. And it's true. And I think the Republicans in this case, the anti-choicers, are their extremism may be their undoing. So I think it's a really interesting point.
But also I think the second piece is, of course, the idea that this is settled. I mean, you know, U.S. Department of Justice filed suit against, was it Alabama? Was it out in our, I forget which state, that doesn't have exceptions for health of the mother.
Idaho, isn't it Idaho?
Excuse me.
Yeah, I think it's Idaho.
So this is going to be litigated. That will, and every case is going to hit the Supreme Court because their opinion was absurd in many ways. And so and so you're going to have just continuing unease in this space. And honestly, I mean, this is great news for whatever your viewpoint is on the on-off switch, about whether there should be a constitutional right to abortion. The vast majority of Americans, as we saw in Kansas, conservative Kansas, do not believe in this extremism that we saw in the court. And I'll say, Republicans get abortions too. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, Republicans used to be pro-choice.
I know. I mean, but as someone I heard an abortion provider say in Kansas, she said, if we only serviced Democrats, we'd have 10% of our clientele, right? I mean, you know, it's like, come on, people. So,
well, you know what else? One last thing. I don't want to belabor this because I mentioned this in the last segment, but women are in a totally different place in 2022 than they were in 1973. I mean, you could barely run the Boston Marathon. You barely had sports in school. You couldn't play basketball in a normal way. You had to have two people
stop
behind.
At half court.
I mean, it was all these crazy, and you couldn't get credit, et cetera, if you became pregnant and your teacher in the 60s, you lost your job. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't even get married as a teacher before that. So, I mean, let's thank the women's movement here a little bit, right?
Yeah.
By the way, for those who think that last statement was the throw-in, your two aunts were teachers.
You
and in those days in Massachusetts, you could not be married and be a teacher.
State senator in Massachusetts, in Fall River, my hometown, Mary Fonseca, worked very hard to change that rule. So if you got married, you could still get your job as a teacher. Elizabeth Warren talked about being pregnant.
Our generation, yeah.
And they said to her, you're going to be pregnant? Are you kidding? Yeah. And you hold on to your job? Actually, somebody told me that when I was pregnant. You can't come back to your job. This is me. I'm
By the way, speaking of Elizabeth Warren, we haven't mentioned this yet because it's just tied up. On Friday the 12th, she'll be joining us at the library for a whole hour of Ask the Senator, Elizabeth Warren. So mark your calendars.
I'll get off my high horse here and move on.
I'm glad you are.
I just think last night was complicated because I think Jim's right. The Secretary of State stuff. But when I looked at each of those states, most of them were really fractured primaries, and I think that people seem pretty confident that three of the four of them are probably going to lean Democratic. I don't know, but there were other, Kansas was a big thing. Eric Greitens the crazy stuff. The Republicans, in some way, sort of saved themselves from some of these really extremism. And if you I think some of these other candidates are going to lose. I mean, Dr. Oz and others. I think. That's why the Republicans are starting to get nervous, and as you see, their money as well. Now, obviously, we've fallen into politics here, but this matters to me because, of course, you've got the Trump sitting in the background, who's planning another insurrection. I mean, who may be president. There's an ongoing insurrection going on. He's lost his bearings in reality, I think it's safe to say, and he breeds violence. I mean, this is clear. I mean, from day one.
Talking to Juliette Kayyem.
Let's put on your Homeland Security hat here and talk about this terrible tragedy down in Kentucky with the awful floods, which are probably, because of climate change, going to recur. How do we deal with these situations?
Yeah, I mean, when you wonder whether leadership matters, Beshear, Kentucky's governor, he's just really fantastic. This is when communities need the driving of resources. He's been completely honest. I think a couple dozen people are still missing, or maybe it's just a dozen now. Gives you a sense of how isolated isolated, I think, is the right word. These communities can be in terms of who lives where. More nomadic communities, more agrarian. So this is going to be, you just have the death issue, right? The sort of, can we protect communities in flood zones, and the saturation of our soil and the continuing saturation of the soil so that it can absorb it is what's leading to these floods that are sort of surprising, not surprising for these communities, but obviously just a shock. The second thing is the impact it will have on supply chain and food. People think of climate change as a as a, you know, as a human centric problem, but it's also obviously a crop centric, you know, it's going to have implications on our crops and our ability to produce farm, you know, in farms and other places. And so farmers and others are a really interesting addition in the same way the military was to the climate change advocacy consortium, right? It used to be just lefties and liberals. Now you get the military, you get farmers and others who just know that things have to get done to protect crops as much as people. But it is,
you know,
this is happening. This will happen all the time now.
Some of the most horrible and incredibly wonderful stories came out of these tragedies, as you mentioned. Oh. The one family lost all four of their kids.
Oh,
kids.
I can't. I saw in that picture.
But, you know, the flip side is Anderson Cooper on your station, CNN, the other night, interviewed a guy, and I feel bad. I don't remember his name. He's bigger than me.
The guy that went and rescued
this guy in the dead of night. He adjusts when he's talking to Cooper. He adjusts his camera so you can see the valley below, maybe a couple hundred feet below, in the dead of night with no lights. Yeah. He wades through the water. At one point, his head is submerged under the water. He rescues three or four children,
on his back.
One under each arm, yeah. One holding onto his back. Then in the darkness. Then proceeds with his wife, he said, by the way, I'm sorry, I forgot her, but she wasn't interviewed. Then proceeds to rescue his two teachers, his, I think, second grade and fourth grade teacher. And he goes on to say, not only is this guy humble and saying anybody in this community would have done it, the love of neighbor of many of these people in these small, poorer towns in eastern Kentucky is as beautiful a thing in the midst of the most horrible of pain. It's just unbelievable what these people are willing to do to put themselves at risk to save their neighbors.
I often say it's so true, and it's almost every community. I mean, I think this is one of the things that's so important about, I think, about crisis leadership and teach about it. But just, you know, is how Trump really played with fissures already in society to exacerbate them through crisis. So, you know, sort of torn apart through COVID, or think about Hurricane Maria and Puerto Ricans and stuff. And the reality is, and why I think I'm ultimately an optimistic person, is that if you could actually bottle up people's goodwill in the moment when their communities are under crisis, which generally is what happens, God, you could solve like a lot of problems. Like people are, I think that's what keeps me optimistic through the work I do, right? I mean, and you see it, and you see what happens when that goodwill is not nurtured or it's violated. Like Uvalde is a perfect example where you have a community that has just, you know, suffered the worst. And then because all these politics are playing out this unfairness, these lies, you know, this community is now ruptured in a way that I don't know if it can get.
What separates those two kinds of communities? The one you'll do anything for your neighbor as opposed to you'll sacrifice your neighbor.
Well, I think part of that is the natural inclination is to help those you know and help your community. I don't the fiction of, say, for example, a crowd stampede, right? That people are just out for themselves. That's actually, it is a fiction, really. People are actually much more aware of their surroundings, much more sympathetic. It's not a dog-eat-dog world, especially if it's your community. And what it just needs to be done is sort of nurtured by leadership in the community. So that's why, you know, this is not Democrat or Republican. I mean, I think that, you know, I was a big fan of Bobby Jindal's during hurricanes. He was a Republican governor of Louisiana. Yeah. You know, I think there are people who have a way of amplifying what I think is generally the goodwill of most, but that goodwill is not well deep. I mean, you know, people will turn on each other if told to do so. If nurtured to do so. And I think Republican or Democrat, you would want our leaders to reflect what's best in us and try to minimize what's worse in us. We're not a perfect people, that is for sure, but we're not all bad.
Well, on that note, we're not all bad.
This is like we're the most optimistic conversation we've ever had with Juliet.
We're not all bad. I'm a glass half full, but we're not all bad.
That's right. Great. You are always a glass half full.
Can I just
person.
Recommend again? I don't know how to search for it because I can't think of the name of the guy. But if you search on CNN and
amazing.
Find this Cooper interview in Kentucky, maybe Google Anderson Cooper.
Very heavyset guy with a bandana on his head.
I mean, heavyset, strong and big heavyset kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just spectacular.
And that's, I have to say, that's Anderson's best.
I agree. That's
his
him
best
his
moment.
Best.
Like, you could put him in front of presidents or wherever. He's great. But those like, sort of, you know, I mean, this is when I see him the most as well, and when I'm on air the most, he's just like, you know, just able to get people to tell their story.
I couldn't agree more.
Our staff found out Nathan Day is
that
the
is
name
his
of
name.
The man in Kentucky.
Nathan Day,
thank you very
you
much,
that.
You guys.
He is just,
he was
check
incredible.
It out, D-A-Y. Yeah. It is really beautiful and worth watching. Juliet, it's good to talk to you. Thanks.
Good to talk to you both. I'll
thank
talk to
you
next week.
Yes,
bye.
We've been speaking with Juliet Kyem, former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under President Barack Obama and the Faculty Chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. She's also the author of The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. Coming up, as we head into another hot week, we hear from the Pine Street Inn's Lyndia Downey on services available to those who are suffering in that heat because they have no home. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, I repeat, in Studio 3, we love the in-person deals, Lyndia Downey. Lyndia, of course, is the president and executive director of the Pine Street Inn, the lead organization serving homeless people and developing affordable housing targeted at homeless individuals throughout New England. Lyndia, it is great to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Well, great to see you again, too, Lyndia. You know, reading through these stories in anticipation of talking to you today, I realize I'm one of those people that thinks, well, you know, blizzards and when it's 0 degrees is a disaster if you are a person without a home. But this is pretty bad, too. So what is the impact of heat on homeless people?
Well, for people who stay out that don't come in, it's obviously can be really serious. A lot of the people we work with are older. They've got pre-existing health conditions. So we worry a lot about the heat. Dehydration mostly, but heat stroke as well. We did take quite a few people to the emergency room last week. This, unfortunately, is lasting a lot longer than a typical heat wave, and the longer it goes on, you know, the more people I think are going to end up in the ER. We're taking out water. Our vans are out during the day. We're trying to get people to come in to the shelter, but not everybody wants to come in.
Yeah, doesn't the city have all those cooling spaces that you can go to, but maybe people don't know about those. They don't feel comfortable in those.
Yeah, and sometimes people can't get there on their own. But yeah, there are some cooling stations, and you know, I'd urge people to take advantage of it because the next couple of days are going to be quite muggy and hot as well.
You know, I should know this, and we should have asked Mayor Wu when she was here last week. Is there an automatic trigger to those being opened, a certain temperature level, or are they there throughout the warm parts of the summer generally?
I think mostly it's triggered when it gets really above 90 or something like that and gets really hot. And they're not opened all year, obviously, and all summer. And look, we don't send our vans out on the street unless it's really, really hot like this and people are at risk. We do send the vans out at night, but not during the day.
You know, we talked the other day to Mayor Wu when she was here about the Supreme Judicial Court, Ohio State and the court in the state's decision on the Long Island Bridge back and forth, basically saying that state decision-making supersedes the objections of the city of Quincy. Mayor Wu, in typical fashion, was very respectful of the mayor of Quincy and agreed with him. And we asked him, his response was, this isn't the final step in this thing. She said, we want to work with him, etc. Where are you and where do you think the mayor is? And what's the potential of Long Island should there be either a bridge or ferries, as she's talked about? What's the potential there?
Oh, there's enormous potential. Obviously, it's a huge site. There's existing buildings. The buildings need work. For many, many years, over 20 years, there was almost 1,000 people living out there, either in shelter or in other sober programs, transitional programs. It was a vast, it was a terrific network and a terrific place to have. It's got enormous potential. We have enormous potential to bring that back. however we get people there. But it's going to take time, no matter what you do out there, and it's not going to be a today solution. I think we have to be realistic about that.
But when you say take time, you don't mean just the getting there issue. You mean the rehabbing and the updating rehab, the buildings and that sort
of
thing.
Yeah, the building rehab. If you're going to build a bridge versus a ferry, you've got to figure out the ferry piece. The buildings need work. They've been vacant now for quite a few years, so it's going to take some time.
But this may be naive. In light of the fact that even if the decision had not come down as it did vis-a-vis the bridge, which Marjorie was explaining to me, who follows this more closely than I do, that there's a – Wu's much more interested in the ferry than the bridge, maybe because of the cost and how long it would take and that sort of thing. But in light of the fact that regardless of what the transportation thing was – the value of the site was understood. Why is the rehabbing, if that's the proper verb, not going on anyway in anticipation of something breaking in terms of transportation?
I mean, I think the city knows more about it, obviously, than I do, but I think they're waiting to make sure there's a clear pathway, literally to getting back on there, and there's no legal issues. Barring the legal issues, though, there's no reason you can't start working on the building, but I think you have to define what's going out there, right?
Yeah.
Is it shelter? Is it transitional programs? Is it sober programs? Is it housing? And so you can't start rehabbing the buildings till you have a vision around what you want out there.
But you know, the other thing, having been to, you know, the Boston Islands, the different islands out there, if I had a choice between rehabbing or housing or dealing with my issues, on Melanie Cass Boulevard or looking out at the ocean with the breezes blowing out on Long Island, I mean, it's a wonderful location. Those Boston Harbor Islands are just fantastic. Everybody always talks about how looking at water is a very soothing thing. So it just seems to me that the fact that there hasn't been faster action on that, and I know I'm not a logistics expert, but I know Mayor Walsh always used to say, well, you know, suppose there's a medical emergency out there. Well, we do have helicopters. You know, so
well,
I
also said, well, if there's a fire out there, the ferry doesn't solve the fire problem.
We have fireboats for fires in the harbor, too.
Yeah.
So it just seemed to me that waiting for this bridge, which is going to take years, just doesn't make sense.
You know, it's interesting because when we first went out there, I was somewhat skeptical, isolated, can't get people back and forth quickly. But there was an enormous benefit to your point, which is people were away from their usual gang and crowd, a lot of sober people around you, very soothing environment, a lot of open green space and water. And there is something to be said for that. And so we actually found that there was a group that wanted to go out and loved it there. And it was kind of their sanctuary. But we're a ways away from getting back to that. The medical issues are real. They're going to need overnight EMTs or something. The fire issue is legitimate. But, you know, we were out there for many of us, right? Over 20 years, there was programs out there, and we figured it out. So I think there's solutions to all this. We got to figure out what they are.
Well, in terms of more immediate solutions, for lack of a better expression, I know there were negotiations going on about this roadhouse, this round hotel thing near Mast and Cass. What is the state of affairs in summer at Mast and Cass? And what's the state of – I know there's some tension between neighbors about how long roadhouse will be used and that sort of thing. Where is that, and where does that go?
So right now there's probably 150 people out there on a regular basis, I would say, on the street in a very small area, 3 or 4 blocks. Mostly people are staying out, going into the shelter or one of the low barrier programs at night. But during the day, it's really busy, a lot of active drug use and a lot of activity, period. I think the roundhouse has been a terrific solution for some of the long-term stayers down there. We're running a 30-bed similar program on the Shattuck campus, very low barrier for people to come in, start to engage them in treatment and housing. I think the neighborhood's looking for an end date on the roundhouse, but there is not an alternative right now. And I think giving up that site would just make everything worse, frankly, because then you get all those folks that are in there engaging at some level. May not be where we want them yet, but it's a starting point.
Lydia Downey, what about supportive housing? You guys at Pine Street have done so much work with that.
We love supportive housing. You know, we know it works. We know it closes a big gap for people who need affordability, but they also need some wraparound so they can hold on to their housing. We've got 240 units in the pipeline. We're working really hard on about another 150 units, and we're really pushing this hard as a solution. And we really believe it's part of the long game here.
Can we assume that people – can we step back? This is the most – I mean, when you – a couple of years ago, you and your colleagues at the Pine Street Inn, you know, adjusted your focus to permanent housing being the ticket, which I think it's a fair description of what you did. Yeah, a bunch of years ago on your 50th anniversary or whatever. These projects in, what is it, JP in the Back Bay?
Yeah.
Can you, first of all, describe what supportive housing is and then talk about the projects. And it's so clear to me, a layperson on these issues, that this is the long-term solution for people that we all say we care deeply about. So tell us.
So supportive housing is housing that's affordable. People typically pay 30% of their income, whatever that income is, for the housing. And then we have staff on site, case management, typically some just staff to help people out beyond case management. Case managers are hooking people up with jobs, benefits, health care, mental health care, whatever it might be. And then there's typically some evening and overnight staff just to make sure people are doing okay. And we do use a housing first philosophy, which means we try to make this as barrier free as possible.
Because what does that mean?
It means you don't have to be sober. You don't have to be on medication. You don't have to be physically healthy. You know, you don't have to jump over a whole bunch of hoops to get housing, because part of the reason there's so many people out there is that more traditional housing, including affordable housing, you have to be screened in and you really have to jump over the hoops. I joke sometimes that a lot of us could never get over the bar. We've all done something, right? This housing is trying to lower that bar and say, we're going to bring you into housing where you're stable, where we can find you every day. And, you know, going back to MassCast for a minute, every 3 days there's a new set of people down there. So 80% of the folks that are down there are there for less than 3 days. So when our team goes down on Monday, on Thursday, it's a whole other group. How do you follow people like that and engage them? You can't. And we don't know where people are going. So supportive housing stops that whole cycle, puts you in a stable place, and then you start the engagement process.
And so there was some controversy. Controversy is the wrong word. I'm not saying arguments back and forth between some. Was it a realtor or somebody in one of these locations? But that was not about the notion of having formerly homeless people there. That was that a parking thing or what?
We were taken to court over not having enough parking on the site, which was somewhat ironic because homeless people typically do not have cars. So we found that
point
to be very interesting.
It's a very good point.
But sometimes that is a code for, I don't want homeless people in the neighborhood, so I'll find some other legal angle to go with this from a zoning standpoint.
But do people want homeless people in the neighborhood? Or are they are they willing to accept homeless people in the neighborhood, assuming there is not just plopping people there, but the supports that you talk about? How much of a hurdle is that, I guess, is
what
I'm trying
to
ask.
It's a big hurdle. I mean, I want to be realistic. It's a big hurdle. We're really grateful to the people in JP and Back Bay, where our two new sites are, for supporting these projects. But it is a hurdle. The stereotypical homeless person, everybody knows what people think. People are afraid of it. We've got 34 sites now in Boston and Brookline. And most people don't know we do housing. And I see that's a good thing, because if there's a lot of problems, you'd hear about it.
You know, can you, for a second, I think about someone who's been homeless, finally getting an apartment and being able to close the door and have their privacy and their freedom, I look at it through the lens. I was a tenant lawyer, as you know, centuries ago in the South Bronx. And, you know, when somebody was evicted or lost their house for whatever reason, and the joy in the individual or the family when they got a new place, there's no words I can conjure up to describe that. But those people were used to being in a secure housing, and that's all they wanted, was to get back into one. When you're not used to it, I assume fear comes with it too. Does it? Or is that same level of, you know, that sigh that comes out of your body when you finally got something you deserve? Is it, what's the, I know you can't generalize, but do the best you can.
You know, for some people, it is the life-changing thing. That key is everything, and it changes their entire life. And for other people, it's a huge adjustment, especially for people who stay out a lot. It is a different set of daily routines, a different set of staff often. And some, for some people, it feels very foreign. And we work really hard when we move people in the beginning. We put a lot of intensive services in the first 6 months, because typically that's where people struggle the most. And then you hope over time people stabilize. So it's a bit of a mix. I know we think every single person should be grateful for it, and I would say most people are. But for some people, they're leaving their community on the street.
Exactly,
they're feeling lonely often. So it's much harder, I think, than people envision.
Before we continue with Lyndia Downey, head of the wonderful Pine Street Inn, Governor Baker has just announced that the Orange Line will be closed for a month, as was predicted, from August 19th through September 18th, to reopen on September 19th. He goes on to say it would have taken 5 full years of weekend diversions otherwise. So I don't know if the initial idea was brought up by Mayor Wu. She mentioned on our show the other day, but there is a pretty radical solution being imposed that a lot of people think is the right one. We'll bring you more updates on that in a second.
You know, we've asked this question a million times, but we have some texters now. That's our new thing. We get texters. And
new
one
thing.
Of the texters is asking something
us.
I think a lot of people wonder, so we'll ask again. When someone is standing on the corner asking you for money or food, what is the best thing to do?
Yeah, look, this is a. I'm going to tell you my personal opinion. I typically do not give people money. I will get people a gift card. I'll say to somebody, "Do you want a cup of coffee? Do you want a muffin?" I don't do money. I just it. You know, oftentimes people are using, and I don't want to see people use the money to use. Having said that, you know, one of the things we love at Pine Street are gift cards. You know, we all the time when groups are doing drives for us, because you can give them to someone on the street and say, you know, go get something to eat, go get a drink, get in out of the hot. Sometimes that's the key to getting in out of the hot weather. Got a gift card for you. Go sit somewhere where it's air conditioned. So often that small gift card really matters to people. And, you know, we've got staff who just keep them in their pocket. They run to people.
And what kind of gift cards? Like a Visa, MasterCard gift card kind of thing?
No, typically CVS, Dunkin' Donuts, McDonald's.
To a place. To a generic.
Okay. Right. Yeah, anything, exactly. Anything where people can sit and rest, get out of the warm or cold weather.
I have another question. I know you were dealing, obviously, we're talking with Lindy Downey, president and executive director of Pine Street Inn, which deals with people who are without homes. But I wonder, we have heard a lot during the pandemic about the total crush on the mental health system, not just for poor people, but for middle-class people, people that can't get help. How do you see this? Have you seen the impact of this at all, even though you are dealing?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it was hard before this, as you all know. It was not an easy path. I think the field has lost a lot of people. So I think that has made it harder for everybody to get mental health care. There's much more demand now than there was before COVID. And, of course, we couldn't meet the demand before COVID. And so the demand has grown exponentially. But the workforce has not. And even for us, you know, we struggled to hire clinicians, and that's for us the path for many people to get more services through the Department of Mental Health or elsewhere. So it's a crisis, no doubt.
No, but let me just say one note. In light of the fact that we have trashed this pathetic legislature for taking a 5-month vacation, they did do a major initiative on mental health, thanks to a president of the Senate. Spilker has been a big champion of this before they recessed.
And I don't understand exactly what that means. Supposedly now there's going to be mental health parity, which it was supposed to be through Obamacare. Obviously, there isn't mental health parity, so you're treating mental health like a broken arm or cancer or anything else.
Part of annual exams, that kind of thing, too. Yeah,
yeah,
a lot of money.
I'm suspicious on the mental health parity part.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever achieved full parity. It's on paper. You all know this. It's hard to achieve it in reality. The system isn't there to support it. It's much longer often than other care, and more intense sometimes, and that's expensive.
You know, speaking of mental health, if I may for a second, since Marjorie brought it up, I've never seen you not calm. And I have to say, and I've seen you in a lot of settings, you have, one of the most stressful and important jobs. How do you deal with, I mean this sincerely, how do you deal with stress, Lindy Downey?
Well, it's a really good question. I don't know that I'm very good at it. What do? I read a lot. I try and exercise when I can. And I try and keep some perspective, which is really hard, especially these past couple of years.
What does that mean, some perspective?
Just, we work with people whose lives are just totally upended. And we're going to have crises. And you have to kind of titrate what's a over-the-top crisis versus the day-to-day stuff. It's hard, though.
Do you take a break in the middle of a day if you're that kind of person?
Yeah,
and what,
sometimes.
Take a walk? Or
get a walk. Go downstairs, whatever it might be.
Okay, so can we talk about another wonderful thing you do, which is just beautiful. Talk about this graduation deal for 75 of your guests, as you call them, at Pine Street.
Yes, and
by the way, there's a huge smile on Lindy's face as she hears the question.
We have a graduation every year for anybody who finishes our job training programs in food services and in housekeeping. And we pick those two areas because we know a lot about those areas. We do both of those. But people graduate, and for people who have literally been knocked down many, many times in their lives, it's a chance to stand up and say, I did this. I'm proud of myself. We do caps and gowns. We do everything. God. We do boutonnieres. I love it. And people are so pleased and proud that they've come this far. And it is such an emotional day for us. It's the day when I stand in front of them and I'm like, I can barely not cry because they've worked so hard to get off the streets. to a job, to a new life, to housing, and it kind of encapsulated everything we do in one day.
Does it translate in, I mean, I don't mean to get into every single detail. Is job placement also part of what you do?
Oh, yeah.
And so a decent percentage, a significant percentage of that 75
we're running about 60% right now because we're in a really great market. Not always like that, but one of the upsides to this market is employers are willing to give homeless people and people with a less than perfect resume
a
shot. And that has been fabulous.
Here's
another good question. What do you do with family members, either they have an alcohol problem or they have a drug problem, who refuse to get help? There isn't much you can do, is there?
No, we work with people in shelter and on the street who don't want to get help. And in fact, that's actually more common than people who agree to treatment. And so it's a very slow engagement process. If we worry that people are really sick, both on the mental health side and on the substance abuse side, we'll try and go either for a Section 35 or a Section 12, which is an involuntary commitment. Mm-hmm. We don't do those often.
Yeah.
It's a high bar, frankly, to get the courts to agree to it. But also we don't want to, disabuse our trust that we have with people. But it's a slow process.
And
I could tell you.
They don't go for treatment because they don't think they have a problem or because they just think it's not going to work or –
sometimes people don't think I have a problem. I think most people know. I've run into very few people on the street who don't say, I get how bad things are. People can't envision a different life. They can't envision getting clean. I think, these opioids that are still not new anymore, it's very hard for people to get enough clean time, even a little clean time, so you can engage with them and say, what about some treatment? What about something other than MassCas? It's a long road and a slow one.
Okay, so with the exception of volunteering for Thanksgiving, which we're not going to talk about, if people want to do gift cards, want to make a contribution, want to volunteer their time, how do they make that happen, Lindy Downey?
Just go on the website. Just go on the Pine Street website.
Which is?
PineStreetInn.org, all one word. But, we appreciate the help. We especially appreciate the gift cards and, some of these smaller things that allow us to really
gift
engage
cards.
With folks.
I didn't even think that. I should have thought that before.
Do you videotape this graduate? I'm crying, by the
way.
Is it available? Is it online
we'll send
or something?
We'll send it. Yeah. We do.
And we'll
we have
tweet it out if it's okay
you.
With you.
Thank
it's
you.
Just,
yeah,
it's
we'd
really,
love that.
Well, people's families come too, right?
Oh, absolutely.
So it's a whole family affair.
So
you
great.
See mom who struggled, or sister who struggled, or child
Your child. We had somebody in this last graduation whose parent was there. Who came up and said, look, my son, it's the first thing he's ever finished, first thing he's ever graduated from.
Oh,
and it really changes people's lives. So it's a great day.
Send us the video,
will you?
Hey, it's wonderful to see you as always, Lindy Downey.
Yeah, thank
you
so much. Lindy Downey is the president and executive director of the Pine Street Inn, who's looking very calm, as Jim says. She is looking very calm.
As opposed to the two of us.
Well, yeah, particularly
one of us.
Coming up. Travel is on our minds this summer, and Rick Steves is fresh off his latest European tour.
That's a nice
He's going to tell us all about it next. Rick Steves is next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We're joined by Rick Steves. Rick is an author, television, radio host, the owner of Rick Steves Europe Tour Group. You can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights at 7:30 on GBH2 and his radio show Travel with Rick Steves. That's Sunday at 4 on GBH89.7. His latest, I cannot wait for this, and I know you feel the same way, Marjorie, a six-hour series, Rick Steves Art of Europe, will be available to GBHers starting in October. Rick, pleasure to see you. Welcome home.
So nice to be home and nice to be with you again.
Great.
Well, we want to hear all about the places you visited for this big series coming up in October. But before we get to that, I just wanted to ask you the overall state of affairs now with travel in Europe and the pandemic. What's the atmosphere over there?
Yeah, well, right now we've got about 30 buses in Europe all over the continent. And this is kind of the quiet time of the year for us because in our sales, taking Americans to Europe on these tour buses, May is the big spike, and then September is the big spike when we've got about 100 buses on the road. So right now, a lot of people stay away from Europe because it's so hot and so crowded. But those who are there are finding that people are kind of living with COVID, and it varies a little bit from country to country. But the question is, when is it going to become just a bad cold instead of something that you have to isolate for? We're still, keeping the bar really high. But I think Europe is on the way to that endemic kind of approach to COVID. There's, in the newspaper, we hear a lot about the chaos in the airports and everything, and that disturbs me. I'm going to Europe in 2 weeks, and I want to minimize the chance that I'm going to be stuck in an airport like these horrible pictures you see. I'm making sure that me and my loved ones and our tourists never pack a bag. That's the key. 9 by 22 by 14 inches is as much as you give yourself, and you carry that onto the airplane, even if you don't want to, because you need to be nimble in the airports. Give yourself a couple hours extra to get to the airport, and don't book tight connections in Europe. Having said all of that, again, we've got 30 buses. That means hundreds of people in Europe right now. And I keep asking my staff, what impact has that had on our American travelers in Europe? And almost none. So as media goes, you know, you see the worst scenario on the headlines. But if you're just smart, you should be okay. Big news is the dollar is about the same value as the euro now.
Yeah.
So there's been terrible inflation, but that is pretty much negated by the strength of our dollar compared to the European currency.
You know, I wanted to know, I can't be the only woman that always overpacks no matter where I go. It's ridiculous. So I'm wondering, what are the things that we do wrong? Do we take too many shoes, too many blow dryers, too many cosmetics? I mean, what is it that people overpack? Generally.
You know, I'm going to Europe with my girlfriend in 2 weeks, and we have this discussion because, you know, we have to be light and nimble. And my philosophy is packing light is not a hardship. It's a blessing. It frees you from having too much stuff. And I think as Americans, we're prepared to be packing for the worst scenario.
Yeah.
And I say pack for the best scenario. You can buy it if you need it over there. It's worth a lot of money to be packing light. And don't worry about how you look so much as in the sense of, do I need something different to wear all the time? You're moving around so fast, nobody knows you're wearing the same stuff every other day except your travel partner, and that person's doing the same thing. But I get pretty intense about being light, packing light. I live out of a 20-pound bag for a quarter of my adult life. It's carry-on the airplane size. On our tour program, nobody gets on a Rick Steves tour bus with more than that much luggage. And it's a great way to put yourself on vacation. So I don't care. There's no excuses. A lot of times people look for excuses. Man, woman, rich, poor, north, south, 2 weeks, 2 months. It doesn't matter. You need to be able to carry your own luggage when you're on the road. To me, there's two kinds of travelers, those who pack light and those who wish they pack light. So, you know, it's worth working on, Marjorie.
Let me just tell you, okay. She does need to work on. She brings more than 20 pounds of crap from home to the studio every day.
I do.
Much less to
it's
Europe.
Like I'm going away for 2 weeks instead of 7 hours.
You know, Rick Steves, before we get to your filming of this series that we introduced a couple of seconds ago, one of the things you talked to us about that really mattered the most to me in anticipation of your return to Europe a few months ago was what was going to happen to so many of the small little independent businesses and restaurants that you write about so beautifully, which is, I think, one of the things that causes people to love your books, too, and everything else. It's these out-of-the-way, wonderful things. You were worried about their survival. Was the worry justified, or did most survive?
You know what's really exciting to me, and I'm so thankful for it, because you're right. What distinguishes my books and my approach to Europe is to find those little mom and pops, mm-hmm. those little bed and breakfasts, the little cafes, and the labors of love, the entrepreneurial ventures where you really get the personalities. And my favorite restaurants, I always think, are personality driven. If I think of my favorite five restaurants in every major city in Europe, it's probably got the same formula, mom and pop, you know, one cooks, one serves. They've got a beautiful little spot that's on a low rent street in a good location, but not on the main square where you snare all the tour groups. Mm-hmm. And thank goodness those places have survived. It's been all hands on deck to update I've got 50 guidebooks that cover Europe from top to bottom. I thought we were going to be raking away the corpses of all my favorite businesses, but it's been good news. And to a great extent, it's because all of these businesses, they are not some investment by some big corporation that has a chain, but they are just what a person does. And one thing that charms me about Europe is people find their niche. That's what they do. And they do it with gusto, and they do it with pride. And they don't do it thinking they're going to hopscotch into something that pays better or gets more esteem somewhere else. They get the esteem doing what they find they're cut out to do. My favorite guides are cut out to be guides. My favorite restaurateurs are cut out to be serving food. My favorite hoteliers are cut out for hospitality. And our challenge is to connect with those people. To connect with those people is what really carbonates the experience. So all in all, it's good news as far as little businesses surviving COVID.
So Rick Steves, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we're talking to Rick Steves, and he's got the six-hour miniseries. Rick Steves' Art of Europe is going to be coming out to GBH members starting in October. So you filmed this when you were over on your recent trip. So give us a little preview.
Well, we've been working on this for about 2 years, Marjorie. It's this six-hour miniseries, which is something I've wanted to do for, I think, 20 years, is give America an updated look at European art, because I grew up on Kenneth Clark's Civilization, which was very stodgy, very, very brilliant. But boy, talk about let's lighten it up here and not scare people away from the art. And so my work is to make art fun and accessible. I do that as a tour guide and so on. And I just love the art. So over the years, as people who enjoy my show on WGBH have seen, I've been in every one of the great museums and galleries in Europe and you know, spliced it into our various episodes. And I thought it's time to go from the pyramids to Picasso and just have a six-hour sweep through art in a way that's fun and engaging and compelling. And I went to Europe three times with my crew in the last year to lace it all together. Of course, we drew from things we had shot over the last couple of decades. And this last trip, I was just in Bruges, Madrid, and Vienna. In earlier trips, just within the last few months, I've been in Florence, Rome, and Athens, and in London, and in Paris, and out by Avebury for the Stonehenge-type stuff, and into the French countryside for the beautiful Gothic cathedrals. And now we've got it all done. And we're just finishing it up. And it was so much fun to be in Madrid and Vienna. And it was like finishing up a massive jigsaw puzzle. There was just a few little pieces left. We needed pudgy winged babies. You know, we needed, a prince 6 years old on a horse painted looking like no little kid can look on a horse because it's propaganda. We needed hidden self-portraits, these last little pieces for the puzzle, and then put it all together. And it's just, for me, it's the creative joy of my career is putting this together and sharing it on public television.
You know, one of the things, I know you mentioned Madrid and the Prado, if I pronounce it correctly. And the thing that I love about this, when I was reading what you wrote, is that you and your colleagues were given, what, an hour before the museum opened and were told you had to pick five paintings that you wanted to check. How great a moment is that? Both the selection and the hour by yourself in a museum. It sounds so great to me. Describe it to us if you would.
Jim, it's great, but it's also cruel because it's
maybe
when we were in the Prado, we figured we could almost do the whole show just in this museum. Yeah. And I love the self-portrait of Albrecht Dürer, because it's the first time a painter has painted himself with so much pride, and it recognizes the humanism that came with the Renaissance. And you see this guy looking like Jesus, who's painted himself with these amazing hair and this amazing, you know, blouse and the confidence in his face. And can't we just set up the tripod just for 2 minutes and get a shot of that? Nope, it's got to be these five shots. And so we had a local guide. We cased it all out, and he had actually tracked the best route, because every minute mattered. And I had the clock going all charted out. And, the cameraman doesn't like me looking over his shoulder telling him you got 2 minutes left. But in this case, we had to do it. And we were like a precision team when we got those five amazing paintings. Each had a major slot in this show. There was Velázquez, Rubens, Rembrandt, Goya, and I think an El Greco. And boy, just to be there with our lights, with the sticks, in an hour before the mobs hit the museum, all alone with that great art, and to then read the script as we're filming it and see how beautifully we can cover it when we're there shooting it intentionally for this little bit of script. It was just, if you're making an art show, it was just a thrill. And then the funny thing is, we went later to Vienna, and at the Kunsthistorisches Museum, which is just as good as the Prado, they said, how much time do you want? You can do anything you want.
Wow.
Have fun.
Well,
so it was a totally different thing in Vienna.
Okay, you teased us in your memo to us, Rick Steves, talking about Vienna, with a subhead that said Baroque sex and inbred kings with underbites. So please do tell.
Well, Well, Marjorie, can you imagine a better heading for a Facebook post than Baroque sex and inbred kings with underbites?
No. So those wild, I got to admit,
that was a cheap trick just to get a few more clicks.
Inspired.
The funny thing about European culture and art is until 1918, the whole place was owned and run by five or six imperial families or royal families.
Wow.
And the real consequence of World War One in so many ways was that was the end of the Hohenzollerns, the end of the Habsburgs, the end of the Romanovs, the end of these royal families. We still have royal families, but they're all constitutional monarchs now. Mm-hmm. But back then, before, you know, in the old regime, was this notion of divine monarchs. I mean, this guy, God said he gets to rule me and I have to be his subject. And that was accepted until, you know, modern times. That's kind of what the whole French Revolution was fighting against. And these guys were so elite that they really intermarried with their cousins. And all these families eventually seemed to be related. And of course, when you have a small gene pool like that, eventually you get some distinctive characteristics. And the court painters painted all of these portraits. It was like Tinder for the old days. I mean, everybody had their portrait, and this would be sent around Europe as an eligible princess. Here's a portrait of her. Would you like to get together? And, you know, these were mostly set up marriages where they slept with whoever they wanted to, but they were married to this person because that would put the two realms together. And it was just a fascinating mess. But you do have this funny thing. I find that kings have all of these weird features, and the Habsburgs have this really strong underbite. And the court painters, they painted it.
They did.
Just boldly. And I don't know quite what the story was there, but I do know that court painters were hired to make the royal family look good, underbite or not.
Do you imagine what they really looked like if that's what they ended up with in the paintings, Rick Steves?
Exactly. Oh my God. But one thing I did notice is that the greatest collections of paintings in Europe mirror not the most important cultural powers today, but what were the most important cultural powers 200 or 300 years ago. And today, the three greatest paintings are the three greatest galleries, I think, are in Vienna, in Paris, and in Madrid. And that's because, you know, 300 years ago, the most powerful ruler in the world was the emperor of Spain, or the king in Spain. He was both an emperor and a king. And consequently, he had a huge collection of paintings. I mean, that was back when the Netherlands, you know, Amsterdam, was called the Spanish Netherlands.
Yep.
I love Bosch, and his greatest stuff is not in Flanders where he lived, but down in Madrid, because that's where the king could gather it.
You mentioned the your favorite gallery, one of them being in Paris. Which one is that?
My favorite gallery in Paris is the Louvre.
The Louvre, okay.
But what is really interesting that I've noticed is when you go to sightseeing Paris, as many people have, you've got sort of a trio that takes you through art history. The Louvre, it goes up until 1850. And then you got the Orsay Gallery,
yes,
which goes for the 100 years after that. And then you got contemporary art in the Pompidou. And in Vienna, you'd have the same thing. In Madrid, you'd have the same thing. In London, you'd have essentially the same thing. So we found that we had to kind of think, do we want the version of the Louvre with all of the great masters? Do we want to get Monet and the Impressionists and Van Gogh and Degas? Or do we want to get the contemporary, you know, abstract art? And that would be one of those three museums that kind of cover the whole sweep of things in these great cities. And what we wanted to do with our art series is cover the whole sweep of things also in 6 hours. And that was the challenge. You know, Ken Burns has all the hours he wants. He took 18 hours to talk about baseball.
That's right.
A little tension here between two PBS guys,
I
should say.
You need some more hours, Rick Steves. No question about it.
Hey, Rick, I think it was in your Facebook posting about Vienna, but wherever it was, use the term, which I loved. I don't know why it like jumped off the page. Fury of the brush.
Oh, yeah.
What's the genesis of that?
You know, I always like to look at the economics behind things. And Peter Paul Rubens was the most prolific painter in a lot of ways in his age, certainly. He was a Baroque painter from Belgium. And he cranked out more masterpieces than any single person could ever paint. And the point is he had a studio and he had all sorts of assistants. And he would paint a little sketch and it would be rough. And then his students or his studio would paint a giant fresco, 20 feet tall, you know, and then he would come in and he would give it what they called the fury of the brush, which is just a little glimmer in the eye and a little pizzazz there and a little more background there. And then it would be rolled out and sent off to his rich patrons anywhere in Europe. So he was mass producing these masterpieces, and he came in and gave it the fury of the brush. And that was just something I remembered from my college professor, art history professor. And as I was, you know, working in that, I really thought, I'm so thankful that I had teachers that inspired me, both on public television and also in my education. And I just wish my teachers were there where I could thank them 40 years later, that, you know, you planted seeds in me that just was a love of art. And now, thanks to the gig I've got, you know, with public broadcasting, I can amplify that appreciation of art. And that's just, it just makes me so thankful. And I wish I could get my teachers together and just say, hey, I wish you could watch this because a lot of your words are in this show.
You know, we're talking to Rick Steves, and he's got a special miniseries coming up in October on PBS, The Art of Europe. You know, years ago when I was in Europe and a few free days, my family and I decided to go to Belgium. And the reason we went to Belgium is because of Rick Steves' Belgium, by the way. We weren't going to go otherwise. And we went to Bruges, where I think you were, where I know you were. Am I not right? Is Bruges not one of those car-free downtown things where you park on the outskirts and you take little jitneys? And am I right about that?
Almost. I mean, there's traffic in Bruges, but it's so limited. And generally in Europe, you know, you have to live in a place to be able to bring your car into there. So taxis and residents can come in, but you walk through the streets in Bruges like it is traffic free. And, you know, it's just one of the most touristy and beautiful and idyllic little towns. It's too good to be true. It's the Rotenburg of Belgium, I think. And if you remember it from years ago, Jim, it's exactly the same today. I was there filming 18 years ago, our episode, and I noticed the same tablecloth was on my favorite restaurant. And, you know, you go to Bruges to bike I remember biking on the cobblestones, and you go down the canal out to the windmill, and the best beer in Europe, the best chocolate.
Best beer I ever had ever in Bruges ever. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Isn't that I know there's beer pilgrims, and, you know, I live in Seattle, but there's a lot of people on the East Coast like you guys that beer aficionados that fly over to Belgium to immerse themselves in that wonderful beer culture. And, you know, you have a beautiful day hiking or going to the galleries or shopping, and then you go to a charming restaurant and you wash it all down with beer. it's a different kind of beer. I like, when I want a refreshing lager, I go with a Czech beer or a German beer. But if I want a rich kind of milkshakey beer made in some monastery by a bunch of monks who just are, they're celibate, so they have to get into the beer. I think that's one of the great treats in Europe.
They're often not celibate after they get into the beer, but that's a whole other story.
A whole other show.
How do you decide, forget television for a second, but the tours with people you're taking, how do you decide how much art a person who's not quite as into art as you are, you know they're going to enjoy it, even if they don't know it in advance. How do you decide how much to give them in doses, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I sure do. And that is a challenge because some people can look at art forever, but most people, they're only good for this much, and then their eyes kind of glaze over. And my job as a tour organizer or a guy who writes travel books or leads tours is to really know just how many Madonnas and children a mortal tourist can enjoy in one visit.
Exactly.
Because I find the more you bring to it, the more you'll get out of it.
Yeah.
If you've always not liked art or you've always not been interested in art, you're going to be overwhelmed sooner and it's going to be less rewarding. But if you do a little research, a little reading, and if you just get into it and you have a positive approach, you'll find that art is just, it's such a joy. And to be there with these amazing pieces of art and to know, let art be a time tunnel experience for you. That's what I love about art. And my challenge, and as a travel writer, my challenge, my goal is to help people put themselves in that context. Don't go to St. Peter's Basilica and complain about, you know, how all the money they spent on that art 500 years ago. Understand how religion permeated society 500 years ago and how that was the best they could do to glorify God. See it on its terms. When you do that, it becomes exciting. When you go to Germany and you remember 500 years ago, the printing press was a big deal. And 500 years ago, they were etching. And 500 years ago, Albrecht Dürer was just a businessman. And he did these amazing etchings, and then they could crank them out on a printing press. And Albrecht Dürer was the first mass-produced artist. Imagine normal people affording an Albrecht Dürer etching, because they could crank out 100 of them instead of having Rubens painting one of them. So I just think that really, really helps to know what was going on back then, who paid for it and why, and let the art take you away. I just find myself like a little baby yelps for joy. I just find myself saying life is good when I'm alone in these great galleries, appreciating the artistic genius of people who lived in a whole different world than me centuries ago. We can do that. And with that approach, art can be one of the highlights of your travels, along with that beer in Belgium.
Life is pretty good talking to you too, Rick Steves. We missed you. We're so glad you're back. Enjoy your next trip, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you, as always. Rick Steves' Art of Europe will be available to stream GBH members starting in October. And, of course, that was Rick Steves we were just talking to, author, TV and radio host, owner of the Rick Steves Tour Group. And you can catch Rick Steves Europe weeknights right here, right after Jim's show, 7:30 on GBH2, plus his radio show, Travel with Rick Steves, Sunday at 4 o'clock on GBH 89.7. Thank you so much again to Rick Steves. Coming up, the Boston Globe's love letters columnist Meredith Goldstein is going to be here to tell us stories of love and loss. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. Oh, you can just get old. You're gonna kick off before you even get halfway through.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. There is no relationship question too big or too small for our next guest, Meredith Goldstein of the Boston Globe. She writes the Love Letters column, hosts the Love Letters podcast, where she tackles questions like she wanted to sleep over, but I wasn't ready for that yet. Should I just give it up altogether? Here to answer that question and many others of equal magnitude is Meredith Goldstein herself. Hey, Meredith, how are you?
Hi there.
Hi. You just got some great columns this time that people ask questions for. Let's start.
Before we even start, can we do an over-under?
Yeah.
How long is it going to be before you call her Meredith Vieira? Do you think in this...
If it doesn't happen, I'm going to feel like we didn't have our full experience.
That's okay. How I feel,
all right.
Too.
Well, why don't I say Meredith Vieira now that I try not to say it for the whole rest of the session. Okay. She, of course, is a famous news reporter, but I used to work with her a million years ago, and she was in Providence, and I was in Fall River. Yes, that's right. So let's start with the person that had been in the relationship for 9 years, I think it was, and the girlfriend wanted to see his phone.
Oh, I mean, this is so. Listen, problems change, and you know, technology makes them evolve over time. But I love a very classic hand over your technology question because it just doesn't. And like, you know, the specifics always change of like who has access to what. But you know, I really have always felt like people should have their privacy and shouldn't have to turn over everything. And you know, it's so amazing to me how many people tell me they've snooped, but really just say, oh, it happened to be open or it happened to be right. So, I mean, and this is just something I think we're going to have to deal with for the rest of our lives. It's like, how much access do we want? How much access should we have? And how much should any couple have a personal life? You know, how much should any individual in a couple have?
So what did this woman find on this phone of this guy she'd been with for 9 years there, Meredith Goldstein?
Well, so you're going to have to remind me which letter. I don't have
this. Have I stayed in this relationship too long? She got involved with him when she was 24. He was 33. They have lived together, no kids. And a few days ago, they were looking at pictures together on his phone.
So she wasn't spying.
And she sees that he's messaging a woman she'd never heard of a lot.
Right. And of course, she says, should I just shrug off the hidden relationships like I have for so many years? And that was the moment where I was like, wait a minute, what? So this is, yes, this is someone who's been in a relationship for a long time and sees this evidence right on the phone. So then the question is like, should I just look the other way? And, lately I've been feeling like I've just wanted to say to people, like, we all have different places or different things we can live with, right? And, I basically said, it's not so much what's on the phone, but it's just like this person has a temper when asked to show evidence. And this person is making you feel unsafe in the relationship.
Exactly.
And so many people stay in a relationship because they're like, it's already been this many years.
By the way, you at the end of this thing, and I usually agree with your advice. Have you stayed too long? Yes. The question should have been, should I get a restraining order? Yes.
Right.
Can I fill in the blanks on this damn story? This is one of the great stories you'd tell ever. So he starts screaming at her when she says, I see you've been messaging this woman a lot. And when he calms down the next day, I think I'm going to get this right. When he comes down the next day, he says, you know what I think we should do? I'm really sorry. Why don't the three of us go out and have coffee together? Now, that's a good, I think, rapprochement, to which the woman, how dare she, says, oh, what's her name, by the way? How dare you ask me what her name is? And he starts screaming at this woman again. The only justice in this story is when he locks his phone so she can't look at it. What happens to him, Meredith Goldstein?
He locks himself out as well, which is an incredible piece of karma that, in his effort to hide probably his big deceit, he now cannot get the information himself. Yeah, this is it's amazing all the gaslighting that happens. And I know that word is thrown around a lot these days, but someone's partner will say to them, you're crazy. You shouldn't want to look at this, or you shouldn't have access to this, or you're making something out of nothing. And it's like, you got to go with your gut, right? And in this case, this person hopefully now knows, because all of the commenters who weighed in were like, get out of there.
Yeah. I love the commenters too. Oh, I mean, I just love that you open up your column to let other people give their reactions, because they're great.
You know, we've asked this before, and I'm sorry to remember the answer. When you give advice in a situation like this, which is pretty extreme, not your advice, the situation in my estimate, and pretty scary actually on a serious note, does the person to who sought your advice ever get back to you? I assume they do occasionally and say, I took it. Thank you. I took it. It was horrible. Or do they?
So usually a few times a year, we do a call out for updates. And sometimes I will reach out to someone for an update. Now, if I'm very worried that the email address might be a shared email address or I'm very careful about who I will reach out to. But I often keep in touch with letter writers who check in a year later, 2 years later, when they see that call out. And it's, first of all, it's very lovely closure for the readership. But there are some people who will update me, now the column's been around long enough that I can hear from somebody after a decade. They'll say, hey, remember that guy I wrote you about 10 years ago? Well, now I'm on four guys after that, and I've got a new problem, right? So there's something comforting about that. Like, I'm never getting updates that say, okay, happily ever after. And that's okay, because I think what I learned from these people is that, like, it's a this too shall pass kind of feeling, right? But the problem that was so big that inspired them to email now seems small, and there might be something else. And it's just a reminder that life is just going to keep changing. But, in this case, I do hope that that this person reaches out. We actually had a letter yesterday from a person who found a condom in the backseat of their husband's car.
Oh, no.
That happens. I mean, come on.
They are not a couple. They are after the age of that being necessary.
I see.
And all the commenters were saying, can you please get back in touch with us? Can you please get back in touch with us? We'll be desperate to know what the explanation for that is. And I agreed. I wanted to know as well.
Yeah. Oh, you don't know the explanation yet?
No.
That should be a good one.
They were asking basically, how do I ask my husband what this was about? And I was trying to brainstorm all of these ideas I was thinking, well, maybe he was at a health fair and someone handed it to him. I was trying to come up with all these other reasons why.
He thought he was buying a balloon for a kid's party.
Was a balloon, they're like craft project.
Do we assume this was an unused condom?
It was Unused.
Okay. All right. Okay. Better than used.
In a wrapper in the back seat, and she was like, "Huh, what's that doing there?"
Maybe it's just aspirational. I don't know.
So Meredith Vieira, I have a theory, and I could be totally wrong about this, but I've seen this in my own life, where people who have very rocky marriages, like in their 40s or maybe 50s, because they're fighting about the kids and they're fighting about money and they're fighting about sex. Sometimes, if they hang in there, then they get to their 60s and 70s, and they're much. They kind of, you know, they're either going to make money or they're not. The kids are gone. They're not having sex much. They've settled a lot of their issues. And they seem to have dotages that are kind of nice.
Dotages.
Well, or older years together in the grandparenthood phase or whatever. But so when I saw this column about the guy that got divorced after 26 years of marriage and now wanted to get back in some fashion with his wife, I thought, I bet that happens quite a bit.
You know, I think technology makes that easier, right? Because there are so many ways to reach out to someone who used to be in your life, but now isn't. You know, sometimes people just disappear and other times people don't. I do think that what you're saying is very true, right? Which is that some couples who met when they don't have kids have kids and their dynamic is quite different. And then when those kids leave the house, some of those original qualities that they liked about each other might return.
Yes.
And I, you know, I have to say that, you know, before my mom died, I had this moment like in the years before where I was like, I think my parents might actually be fit for each other now. And they had so long been divorced, right? But I just thought, wow, like they can really get along now. And maybe, you know, I think that about a lot of people. So, I mean, I don't know if that's incentive for people to stay with spouses. And I don't advocate that people stay in unhappy places. But I do think that just in the case of this letter writer who was sort of wondering, well, what's the potential here? Sometimes it can work out that way. And of course, it depends on what broke you up to begin with. It depends on forgiveness and where you are now. And but, you know, it's a romantic thought. I hope it's not too romantic of a thought.
But wait, doesn't she also write to you, Meredith Goldstein, saying that we're both changed people? So
right, yeah.
in addition, so it's possible that the thing that ripped them apart, or ripped may be too strong a word, but separated them, may not be who they are. So, I mean,
well, he stopped having 17 affairs, you know.
Well,
or maybe he stopped gambling or drinking or something.
No, I'm serious. I mean,
even
if you're not in dotage, as you say, which is a little disrespectful.
Well, I just mean,
you don't have to be in dotage in your 60, you know.
No, you're not in your dotage necessarily in your 60, but I've just seen that in my own life, that people that had very tumultuous middle years settle down later on because a lot of the issues that you fought about are no longer issues.
And I think that the smartest people I've talked to about marriage, and of course, everyone knows I am not a married person, so I have to go to a lot of experts to talk about what that looks like and do a lot of, you know, watching of people and reading. But, you know, a lot of really great therapists will talk about a long marriage being multiple marriages.
Yeah.
And so if you think of it that way, of just different phases and sort of the way we reset, I think that, yeah, sometimes you are who you are at your core, but other times you are a totally new person.
You know what? That brings me up a great thought. You know how the people that are in vogue for baby advice, they always change, you know, every 10 years, something like that. Who is in vogue now? Who's the guru in 2022 of relationship advice or marriage advice? Is there
Meredith Goldstein?
I a few years ago, right before COVID, I got to get together with Esther Perel.
Oh, I love her podcast.
And we got together in New York and we filmed a series together about people's unsent letters and love letters to people, letters they wrote to exes, to current loves that they never sent. And I have to tell you how starstruck I was. And that's been the case every time I've interviewed her, because I just think she is not only such a great talker and such a great thinker, but she just, you know, like, listen, that's the person I'd want to be in the room
okay.
with. So I do think she not only is incredibly comforting and empathetic, she's also very realistic about what a modern marriage looks like.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people enter into this for so many reasons, and some of them are financial and some of them are deeply romantic. And it's like, so why do we do it? And why do we stay? And she is absolutely one of the people I turn to as an expert.
Yeah, she does have a podcast. I've heard it before, in addition to books, right? So you can listen to her or you can read her stuff. Esther Perel. Yeah, my daughter told me about her.
So are those, I don't mean to pry, but those beams are beautiful. Is that your house?
Oh, I'm at a friend's house today.
Wow.
I'm at a friend's house today. So they are beautiful beams.
They are beautiful. Expensive.
This is a friend who notices an exposed beam. I hope for everybody who cannot see where I am. It's a very New England exposed beam.
Beautiful.
It's
gorgeous. It's really great.
I was admiring the beams as well.
You
Jim.
Were? Well,
lovely
I thought I should
beams.
Comment.
Lovely
we're talking
beams.
To Maris Goldstein, who not only is Ms. Love Letters, but according to Trenton Kuznera, climb Mount Washington, sort of. Not
in
too
a
long.
Car.
Well, that counts as far as I'm concerned. So,
well, I sent her, she's very outdoorsy, so I sent her a picture from the top of the mountain, and she thought, well, this can't be my friend Meredith.
Close enough. So you wrote what I would consider, as a non-Love Letters columnist, one of the most typical things that you deal with. I need to get over a crush on an old friend.
Yes.
I've been too afraid to tell anyone in my life about my issues, so I'm coming to you. I've been dating my boyfriend the past 5 years. Amazing, perfect match. But then she said, I've been battling guilt because also I have a crush on my best friend. I'm assuming that's a fairly regular letter topic, is it not?
It is, especially when you haven't seen the best friend in a while, because then you get to make up whatever you want about them.
And exactly.
The coolest thing about this letter is that she mentions a book. She mentions a book called People We Met on Vacation by Emily Henry. And yep. Emily Henry is a very popular novelist right now who writes these great romantic stories. And it just goes to show you that when you read a book or see a movie, you can start thinking, oh, well, maybe my life could be like a movie. And maybe my love from middle school is the right person for me. So, yes, it's absolutely typical and not at all rooted in reality. Mostly.
By the way, but you're pretty tough, which you ordinarily are not. You're firm, but your opening line, speaking of that, as I read that Emily Henry book, the thing to remember about it is that it's fiction in italics.
Absolutely. I love that book. And one of the reasons it feels so magical is because it is magical, right? Like, even if you do fall in love with a friend from your past, it's not going to always look like it does in the book or the movies. And this is why we escape, you know, with movies. And it's a fine edit that a book and a movie gets. But in real life, it's hour to hour, day to day. So we got to be ready for that.
Well, one of my favorite podcasts of yours, and there's a lot of them I really love, but one was from a while ago where your producer went out and found the boy that you sat behind, I think it was in college, and you had a mad crush on him, and you never said anything to him. And then your producer went and found him, and you two met via the phone.
Via the phone. And that's another one, right, where, you know, I can't remember if we put it in the podcast or if it was offline, but he just said, you know what, like, you may have thought I was the most perfect person who walked on water, but my wife gets really annoyed with me because I'm annoying. And that's, like, good to hear, right? Because we're all a little annoying. And I think so I do love fantasy crushes and romanticizing of things, but we, you know, especially if we're with someone nice who's real, like, we can't assume that
it's real.
But don't you think, though, that's one of the things people do on Facebook? They go back and they look at their high school sweetheart or their college sweetheart, and sometimes they reach out to those persons. And then if you're married or in a serious relationship, then, you know, that's a problem.
I think they also go on, whether it's Instagram or, you know, we post very edited pictures and very edited lives.
Right.
And we can curate a persona that someone can fall in love with very quickly. And we don't show them, you know, when we have a head cold or, you know, just want to watch TV that the other person doesn't want to watch or forgot to do the dishes. Like, we, you know, we're all full people.
Okay. So let's talk about, here's something that I want to talk about besides your column was the whole post-pandemic dating life, because of course it was very difficult. I saw pictures of people, they both had their masks on, they'd be going for a walk, you know, on the Jamaica Way or something, 6 feet apart.
Or just Zoom meetings.
Or Zoom meetings. So are we back to semi-normal? Are people ready to kiss each other or not?
Oh, I think they are kissing each other. Yeah. And then some. I mean, I think obviously, you know, for some people they are high risk. They have, you know, issues where they do really want to keep themselves a little bit more protected. But for the most part, what I'm seeing is, yes, if people can eat outside, they're eating outside. But, you know, I think the world has adjusted its risk level. And, you know, I think for a while, people were really looking to couple up because they also remembered being lonely in 2020. And I'm not saying that doesn't happen now, but I think we're back to a more normal, for better and worse, online dating life, which is that people are back to messaging me about being ghosted every 5 minutes and having a bunch of bad dates. And there's something, you know, nice about that, but, you know, that return to some normalcy, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out over the next few years with divorce statistics and, you know, who's single and who isn't. I think we're just starting to feel the effects of the coupled people.
Yeah.
Re-entering the dating scene. You know, there are a lot of people who made big life choices, you know, during these last 2 years, and where they fall in this is still a big question.
So sometimes I read your love letters, and I think this person's got to be kidding me. They just don't get this. And I thought that when there was one recently who had a first date with someone. She had, the date wanted to sleep over. The other person said no, she wasn't ready. She's going to drive her home. Then she never hears from this person again. And she keeps wondering what's going on. And I think to myself, well, it's obvious what's going on. The person isn't interested in you, so they're not responding.
And reaches out again and again, by the way, to which she gets no response. Yeah,
right. I mean, I think that the question that the letter writer was wondering was, did I ruin it by not making the move? By not
that's true.
Sleep over, which I think is really interesting, right? It's like, well, if I had, you know, invited that, you know, if I had stayed with that person overnight, would I have shown the right kind of interest? Would they have pursued this? Or did I, you know, what I also love about this letter writer is they write in and say that they made a big romantic evening, had a charcuterie board, had wine, music, right?
Candles.
And then is not comfortable with a sleepover, which I thought was kind of lovely, right? I mean, it's like a throwback of like, we're going to have this really romantic date and then you're going to drive home and I get to see you again. And that's why, and the person really wanted to have a sleepover. So I think this letter writer was wondering, like, do I have to move faster than I move?
Okay, that's fair. I'm sorry. I was denigrating them prematurely.
It's also really interesting to think about. From my memory, this is not a letter where I was sure of the gender of the letter writer. And so, I would like to think that my answer would not change no matter who it is, you know, right? Yep. If you're not ready, you're not ready. And if the person doesn't want to talk to you, the person doesn't want to talk to you. But I think some of the commenters had interesting points on Boston.com about, you know, if this is a man who is not ready for a sleepover, does it make a difference? And I would say no. But it was an interesting sidebar to it.
You don't think a charcuterie board is leading the other person on, Meredith?
Well, let me tell you this. If I'm going to eat a lot of meat and cheese, I want to go home and be by myself because I feel like I'm probably not. At that point, I just want to wear elastic pants.
Yeah. That's right. If you have a lot of maybe cauliflower or something like that, and then
that's
a charcuterie board?
Trust me,
that
for
a problem
other
too?
Reasons, it is.
So what's going on with the podcast, Meredith?
Well, we are coming back with season 7 in September.
Yeah, it's really, I miss it. I
know, I miss it too. Yeah. And you know, we're going to have great stories of big changes. So
that's your theme.
Yes, and we're going to get into Somerville's polyamory laws. We're going to get into
polyamory.
We're going to get into
That?
Well, you shall see, because just sort of public policy changes that make it easier to have more than one domestic partner.
Oh, okay.
We're going to get into a couple that, you know, starts a business together. We're going to get into all different kinds of people who have wildly different lives after a big change. And, you know, I think the theme of it is that, like, we all like to pretend we can control our lives, but sometimes big changes happen to us. Sometimes we choose them, and sometimes they just happen around us, and we got to catch up. So, especially after the last 2 years, it seemed like the appropriate theme.
So I have one last question before we go. So when you get people on the podcast and they're telling their heartfelt tale, aren't they worried that their significant other of 5 years ago or somebody else might hear them? Or, you know what I mean? Sometimes people really they dish the dirt.
I mean, some people do change their first name. Mm-hmm. Some people, you know, we are very careful to make sure we have consent of anyone who's mentioned directly or could be identifiable.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a tough thing, you know, and I even have that issue with letters where sometimes people, even though they're anonymous, you know, if they tell me they live in Braintree and they tell me they live by a mall and they tell me they have three children, you know, it's a small world, especially in Massachusetts, and a small world in general, even on the podcast. So we really do our best to protect people. Certainly people who have not opted in. So, luckily we have a lot of time to put these things together. So we do lots of checking.
Okay. Hey, Meredith, before you go, congratulations on scaling Mount Washington. It's really impressive.
Thank you.
Really, really impressive.
If there's one thing about me, it's that I'm athletic and outdoorsy.
Hey, Meredith.
Right
thank
back
you very
at you,
much. When's
my
the podcast
friend.
Back? In September?
September.
Great.
September.
Thank you very
Meredith,
much. We've missed it.
Take care. It's great to talk to you.
Thank
Bye.
You. Meredith Goldstein. Not what you thought I was going to say. Meredith Vierge. Not Meredith Vierge.
Well
Meredith
done,
Goldstein
Marjorie.
Is a feature writer for the Boston Globe, where she authors the Love Letters column and hosts the Love Letters podcast, both of which are really fun. Coming up, that smell in the air? Well, it's rats. Boston is apparently overrun by rats once more. We're opening the lines to hear your stories dealing with our very favorite rodent. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. Before we get to the topic of rats, which we apparently do fairly regularly here, actually this is relevant because subways often have rats. Governor Baker made this momentous decision, as you knew was coming, at MBTA's Wellington Yard, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour ago. Here's the key segment.
This 30-day period will be the longest service diversion overseen by the T for an entire line so that they can get work done faster, so riders will see improved service, safety, and reliability on a much faster timeline. To put it in perspective, the 30 days of 24-hour access to rebuild and replace tracks across this line will replace what would have taken 5 full years of weekend and evening diversions.
And by the way, the governor's tentatively scheduled to join us the day before the closure begins. The closure is scheduled for August 19th to September 18th. In any case, last night, the Boston City Council took up one of the most talked about issues facing cities and towns around Boston. It's not the T, but the growing number of rats and what to do about them. According to some media reports, complaints about rats jumped nearly 50% since before the pandemic. We've done this kind of segment before, and it's always, I don't know, enlightening. So we're ending today with you. How bad is the rat problem in your neighborhood? What are your rat stories? Or are you sympathetic to their cause? Our number is 877-301-8970 for texting or calling purposes, or tweet us at BOS Public Radio. And just to get you in the mood, if you're not a rat-obsessed or rat-terrorized person, what is the thing in your neighborhood, or particularly in your house or apartment, that does put you over the edge? If it's not a rat, is it a mouse? Is it a spider? Is it a roach? And we'll get to roaches in a minute. That's where Marjorie is making up a story that she says she was involved in, which actually was my story that I told so many times on the air that she made it hers, which is not hers, but that's for another time. What are your deals? Now, I should start this by saying the following. You didn't know this till we decided to do this morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had the rat guy. Cambridge, who is spectacular.
The rat man.
One of the nicest, most accommodating public employees I've ever come across. Came to my house last week because we had a couple of big fat rats on the back porch on the first floor. And it's rather intimidating when you look down from your second floor porch.
Are you kidding?
And you see this thing that looks almost cat-sized, who is just prancing and not even a great speed. If it was a great speed, I'd feel a little bit better about it.
No, nope, so they're bold as brass, Jim.
We had a conversation about it. And you occasionally see a rat in the street in Cambridge. You don't like it very much when it's in your backyard. We just got new garbage cans. They're giving out free garbage cans to everybody in the city because they're better sealed, that sort of thing. So it was a rather trying experience for me. And we want to know what your experiences have been like on the rat front. Are they terrorizing your community? And what are you doing about it? By the way, are you a rat fearing kind of woman?
I don't even, you are. Absolutely. I hate rats. I had one going across my kitchen. I just about died.
You did not.
That was about 10 years ago. I had a nervous breakdown. But
in your house?
In my house,
and
Jim,
what'd you do about it?
Well, I immediately ran out of the house and called the rat man.
And did the rat man come?
The rat was the size of my dog. I had a little
so
dog.
So what did the rat man do?
The rat man trapped the rat.
Actually caught the rat?
I blame my neighbors downstairs for not informing me that a rat had been scurrying around.
But can I ask you a question?
And they put stuff so
oh,
the rat
so another
can't
rat.
In. Yes, can't get into the house. Did you hear about this thing that in Somerville, though? Listen to this.
What's this?
They've got these 50 knee-high metal boxes in Somerville, which I guess they're having a big problem, particularly in Davis Square.
Yeah.
It's a rat trap. When the rodent wanders into one of the boxes, it activates an elevator that carries the rat. The rat up,
this, yeah.
Like Disney's Tower of Terror ride. Yeah. And when the rat gets to the top, it's electrocuted and dropped into a trash bin. Oh.
Well, my response to that story is just don't tell Cy Montgomery. I mean, that's the bottom line about the execution.
Well, apparently it's not really to get rid of rats because they're doing some testing or something like that. Because this story from the Globe says that the real problem is us, our waste management, restaurants, throwing out garbage that isn't tightly sealed.
But I understand that. The increase in numbers, that was always a problem. Was it not? And why is it a greater, we throwing out more irresponsibly in 2022 than we were in 2019?
Construction is always a big thing. There were lots of rats during the big dig. People have them in baby cribs and everything else. And
by the way,
Rebecca,
I was just going to say, because Rebecca is obsessed.
She is.
And if we don't mention it.
It's been an American tragedy.
She's our colleague. Rebecca had a Toyota or something. I don't know what it was.
Toyota.
She's our coworker. And the rats got into her car and ate the wires. Frankly, we pretend like we care. We don't care. But she cares a lot. And then she tells us something like you spray something. Can you put on the
Comrex
what you're supposed to spray on the damn wires in your car so that they don't soy or something? Minty, so you spray
peppermint oil.
You spray your wires under your hood with minty oil and you don't get rats
eating
your
car. This poor person who had a Toyota, and I think it's because the wires are plastic or something. Anyway, you get check engine lights and something's been bitten through.
Yeah.
But this one person who was always bringing her car to the mechanic popped the hood and found chicken bones, bread, part of a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich sitting there because the rat was bringing that food into the car to eat. And that's what upsets people. They think, am I starting my engine? It's going to be a little rat family inside the hood of my car having their breakfast when I whiz away, and one of the tiny rats will be thrown onto the highway.
So I created a sense of suspense here on the roach front. I want to just tell that story quickly, and then we'll get to your calls at 877-301-8970. For about the first 10 years we were on the air here, I told a story every once in a while when it was appropriate. When I lived in the Greenwich Village when I was in law school, there were a lot of cockroaches, and cockroaches never bothered me. I have no idea why. And I told the story about how, for fun, late at night, I'd turn off all the lights in the apartment, put out a little chunk of cheese, and then I'd turn the lights on and see how long it took for the cheese to be so overridden with cotton. No, you did not. So overridden with cockroaches that you couldn't even see the piece of cheese. It was sort of a fun game. So all of a sudden, 2 years ago, we're talking about cockroaches on the air. And Marjorie tells the story. She says, I was living in an apartment or wherever. And you start talking about
it.
You put out a piece of cheese. You know, you did not. You heard story.
You
appropriated my story.
You know what's possible?
It is not possible.
It's possible that many people with cockroaches do the same thing.
Okay, and why is it the first 20 times I told the story you didn't tell yours? Because it never happened. 877.
You said I appropriated his story.
301-8970. And now Rebecca. My God, help her.
Look at the picture.
Mice got so bad in my apartment, my dad sent me this thing where it's a special contraption.
Mice are supposed to march up and put themselves into
She's
the trash.
She's got a rodent problem.
Mice don't bother me.
What?
Mice don't bother me.
I don't like them in my house.
So many mice.
Outside, it's fine. In your house, you don't want
even
them.
In the house. I mean, how many houses have you lived in without mice?
Not many.
They're everywhere.
Not many.
They're everywhere.
I don't. By the way, spiders don't bother me ever at all.
Okay, I have a
quiz.
What
do you call it? What are those things called? Cockroaches. They're disgusting, but they don't bother
me
at all. We got to do the calls. What do you want to say?
But I just want to point out that there are other things that people are afraid of besides rats, snakes, bats. They're also
bats. I had a bat in my house.
Well, who hasn't?
Okay, sorry.
Human endo and exo parasites.
What?
You know what those are?
No.
I didn't either, but
okay,
I looked it up.
What else?
Endoparasites are things like worms that attack you from the inside. And exoparasites are things that attack you from the outside, like scabies. Is it scabies or scabies?
I don't know.
Bed bugs, fleas, lice. Your kids ever have lice?
Oh, of course.
Oh, that is really disgusting. You have to have the lice brush.
No, you don't. You buy a vacuum cleaner, a canister vacuum cleaner, and vacuum them out of their heads. It does. It works sometimes. Okay, so that's it.
Okay,
for that.
Mario from Hull is on the phone.
Mario. Hi, Mario.
Hi, Mario.
What's the story in Hull down there? Say something, Mario. Hello?
Hello, Jim.
Hi. Mario, you act like we called you.
Listen, I'm busy. I'm busy. I'm putting it on hold. Listen, I have a problem with my tomato garden. I think it's rats, big teeth marks. What do you think, Jim? You're a food.
Absolutely. Mario, Dan from Watertown just emailed the same thing.
On
he texted.
That topic?
He said, I have a community garden plot in Watertown. He's not near you in Hull.
No.
But the rats have destroyed at least half his tomatoes. These varmint.
The big ones. They go for the big tomatoes.
So what are you doing about
them?
You put up fencing or what?
Well, I got a night vision. I got a little BB gun night vision telescope. I'm going to go out tonight. Let's see what that does.
Yeah, can you call us and let us know how it goes,
I'll call
Matt?
You next week.
Yeah, please let me know. By the way, the most.
What do you think I should do, Jim?
No, I think the BB gun's a great idea. Just call us. Just don't come near us. Mario, thank you for the call. Do you see the disgusting photograph Aiden just sent us? You're looking at the Comrex. This is this his actual toothbrush? This is a toothbrush with a roach
with a crawling roach
up. Now that is a little creepy.
The roach is
even
brushing
for me.
Its teeth, Jim.
No, it's not brushing its teeth. Actually, it's shaving. That is totally true. 877-301-8970. The reason we're doing this, Marjorie is making light of this, like she does about everything. But we're talking about because the rat population in Boston
exploding.
Is up. I had two rats on my back porch on the first floor. Had the rat guy come, who, as I say, is one of the finest public employees
love
that you've ever come across.
They're terrific.
And Marjorie had the rat guy in Brookline come do her thing, too.
There are rat men everywhere, Jim.
No, well, good ones and bad ones. We got the
true.
Good ones.
This is a good point by Paul. I think this is Paul from Worcester, who says that instead of killing rats, some cities use bait with a chemical that makes the rats sterile, so no more baby rats.
Yeah.
And that's a big issue because they procreate like crazy. Not as well as rabbits, Jim, but they're close.
Yeah. Let's go to Tamsin in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio. We really appreciate your call. Hi there.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a big fan of your show, and I've never called before, so this is kind of fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So my story is that over the winter, my husband's little sports car in our garage the alarm kept going off, and it's a convertible, and we thought something was wrong with the top. We didn't know what was wrong, but anyway, it was becoming a real problem. We couldn't leave it locked anywhere without the alarm going off, so we took it to the dealership, and they started taking it apart. They replaced the part. It didn't work, kept happening. Anyway, long story short, it turns out that a mouse had gotten crawled up through a tiny water hole in the bottom of the car and had built a nest under the seat of the car, the driver's seat, and had started chewing on the main wiring bus for the car. So we didn't know how many wires he had hit, which means that the whole wiring bus needed to be replaced.
What'd that mean?
It's the place where all the wires for the car connect, and we didn't know how much damage he had done. And the only way to really be sure that we caught the whole problem was to replace this entire custom-made wiring.
How much that cost?
Well, we're still in the process. This happened about 6 months ago. And we're still waiting for the parts because they're made in the Ukraine.
Oh, my God.
Oh my God. They're
talk
made
about a
in Ukraine.
So what are they estimating this is going to run you, Tamsin?
Oddly enough, it's covered by insurance, but it's going to be about $15,000.
Oh, my. And it's covered by insurance. Tamsin, tell the truth. Raise your right hand.
Me,
wait, Tamsin, are you related to Rebecca or no?
I don't know who Rebecca is.
Okay, then. I assume you're telling the truth. Boy, that is a horrible. Can I ask, what kind of car is this?
It's a Porsche 911. That's 2018.
Wow. La-di-da. Well, that's a nice car.
Hey, keep us surprised, and thank you for your first call. Isn't it interesting that her first call with who's – look who's answering the phones right now. What a coincidence. It's Rebecca, and a call about mice eating the wires in a car is right
very
up
suspicious.
There. How'd you like to spend – well, she said it was Tamsin, said it was covered by insurance. $15,000. I never even heard of this wire-eating thing until Rebecca said
well, apparently
there's
a big
story in the New York Times about it, too.
Big story in the New York Times. That's right. They're everywhere. They're eating their way through every car in Brooklyn. Sarah on Twitter says, I had a mouse climb up my arm as I sat in our sofa on Christmas morning.
God.
Needless to say, Christmas morning gifts opening happened at the dining room table with our feet on the chairs. Jay from Lowell
says, "Worst Christmas ever," she
says. There's a beautiful park across from Haymarket Square. You know where that is?
Well, there's a lot of food there.
Has sunken walkways around the perimeter. At dusk, there's a rat tidal wave. Hundreds of rats jump down the walkway and jump up to the plantings where they have burrowed, Jim.
That's beautiful. And by the way, on the flip side, because we have to have an upbeat thing at least in the final segment of the day, a pizza rat is one of the best videos walking down the subway steps in New York City with a whole slice of pizza in its mouth.
The triangle is in perfect shape,
ever.
And the rat is taking it down step by step by step.
If you've never seen Pizza Rat, just Google
pizza rat,
and you'll see
great.
It in a second. Go.
Amy in the car, thank you for calling.
Amy, what's up?
Hey, my first call. I love
another
your
one.
Show.
Thank you.
Yep.
I have a wonderful Weber Spirit grill.
Love Weber
and
grills.
And I acquired a grill mouse. So after I grill, I get the lid, and then the next day I go in out there to grill again because it's grilling weather, and there would be mouse poops.
Oh.
All on the bottom of it.
Oh, no.
Pull out tray. So, of course, out comes the bleach and the hose, and I get it cleaned up over and over again.
What's that about?
I have no idea how I tried to put, you know, tinfoil and weights on the bottom so it couldn't crawl up through where the drip pan comes in and closed up the side holes where you have the rotisserie holes to keep it out. Could not figure out where it was coming in.
Oh, my God.
So we figured this out yet?
No, actually, I don't know how it ever came in, but I went on the internet and I got the Irish Spring soap. So yeah. I hung it in little like bags, net bags around it.
And?
They ate it.
Oh, my God.
What is it? And that, does that kill them?
And ate the soap.
Oh, God.
I repelled them. So I finally got like quarter inch heavy duty chicken wire and made basically a cage all around every single hole of my grill and have not seen it again since.
Well,
boy,
I mean,
you are
creative.
Really persistent.
You are persistent.
They were like Terminator mice.
You can grill the mouse. I mean, that's another possibility. Just that'll teach them a lesson. Amy, thank you for your first call too.
You know, Louise,
isn't it interesting
Morris
rats and mice get first calls from
people?
Yeah,
has a good point. You have to be very careful with rat poison because it kills birds. It also can kill dogs. I've had we incident my own kid's dog with rat poison in the closet.
I know that.
And if they eat any of it, they can be, I mean, they can die, so you have to be very, very careful.
So that's
we
it.
Time here?
No, we don't. It's very
sad.
Oh,
we
sad.
Are at a time.
There's
I'm
never
very
enough
sad.
Time for good rat stories.
There's
I've
a lot. Well,
found.
A lot of people are very upset with us, Jim, because they're eating their lunch and we're talking about rats. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Steve.
You know what's sad? That you didn't have enough time to
Mike.
Tell us a story about when you put a piece of cheese
that's right.
out.
I did put a piece of cheese
it
out.
It was covered I with did. Roaches. Do you remember that story?
I did. That
when did that happen
Jim,
to you exactly?
When I was living in the Back Bay.
And what year was
the
that?
Corner of Commonwealth Avenue and Berkeley Street. I should have bought that place, let me tell you.
Should have.
That was a big
should have bought the triple decker in Chelsea. See what you're going to buy for
Chelsea.
Years, too.
I should have bought a
How'd
lot
that
of things.
How'd that go?
I'd be
well?
Like swinging easy,
We're
easy
done now.
Right now. We're done. Okay. Keep up with us 24/7 if you had enough by way of our podcast, which is the whole show, 3 hours, our podcast, Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for NBC's Chuck Todd, Boston Globe climate reporter David Abel. I can't wait to talk to him about this disaster in Kentucky and elsewhere. Former Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral and our tech writer Andy Nocco. And we're trying again to open the lines and hear the stories you want to tell us about.
Oh, turn the table
that's
thing.
Gonna, that's right. Oh, is that tomorrow?
Yeah.
Oh, turn the table. Okay.
Whatever it is.
Are they going to tell us what they want us to talk about?
Yeah.
Our crew is Zoe Matthews, Aiden Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Tauber, who is obsessed with mice eating the, or rats eating the wires in her car. And John Claude Parker, executive producer Jane Bologna. What's on TV, Jim?
Well, Rachel Rollins is the U.S. attorney for Massachusetts. She's going to join me on white supremacy. We've talked to her about it before, but it continues about a decision from a court about people from 18 to 21-year-old who had been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. That is now in the process of changing a whole bunch of things with her. And then sports betting is now legal here. David Friedman, executive vice president of the Red Sox, he's a lawyer too there, is going to join me, as well as the head of the organization called Massachusetts Council on Gaming and Health. Sports betting and the U.S. attorney, that's all tonight at 7 o'clock. And our debates resume next Monday and Wednesday.
You know what I forgot to mention?
What's
several
that?
People said you want to get rid of your rats and your mice?
Yeah.
Get a cat.
That's possible. Some rats scare cats, though. I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you
Bye.
Can tune in tomorrow and have a great day.